On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Yeah, the program is finally live. Awesome. It's a minute past the hour on this, the fourth day of December 2013, as poor old tired 2013 wanders toward its ignominious end. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the Listen Live button. That is also where you will find... you'll find the access to the chat room, which folks are wandering into now. Sparky's there. Mr. Gibson's there. I'm there. Senor Bean is there. Tim from L.A. is in there. Come on by. Program's live. The conversation's lovely. The wonderful. Whatever you choose to describe it. And also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will find, of course, the ubiquitous PayPal button, as well as the traditional mail address. That traditional mail address is, of course, The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V 25801. And if you prefer to use the traditional mail to help help keep this program running, it is much appreciated because, Boss Man Wayne likes for that mailbox to be much more of a repository for actual mail than a haven for wandering spiders or echoes. So I think I can speak plainly that, yes, he likes to get mail there. Boss Man Wayne does. You can also use the PayPal button. And, of course, here on the 4th of December, we are already behind, but that has a lot to do with the fact that I was gone for a couple of days. Gee, Bob, why were you gone for a couple of days at the very beginning of the month? Simple. Parenthood. The last two nights have been engaged with my son, whom you know, Ferg, taking 2 days of testing. It was the GED. Because we're hoping he can get past that hump and we can get busy trying to get him into college somewhere. I'm proud to announce that of the sections that have been graded thus far, five sections, he passed with flying colors. One remains to be graded, and that is the written portion of the test, and I'm hoping that that he will have scored well on that also so that he can be awarded his GED and we can go on from here. Gee, Bob, why did he get a GED instead of... Well, we've talked a little bit about on this program about the dismal state of public education in Fayette County, West Virginia. And the fact of the matter is, our youngest two kids are no longer in the Fayette County school system here because it is an abysmal failure. There's nothing quite like having your son come home on October the 1st and explain to you that his teacher was in a classroom screaming that N-word Obama to make you lose faith in the educational integrity of a county school system. So he just punted. He said, "Dad, I can't stand." And he said to his mom too, "Mom, Dad, I can't stand another day up there. It's just awful." So that's where Ferg's been. That's where I've been, getting him hopefully through the GED. My part of getting him through the GED was just a matter of sitting and waiting in the car. So far, so good. It'll be about a week before they do the written, before he has a score on the written portion of the test. Cross thy fingers. But anyway, yeah, that's why I was gone a couple of days. And I want to let you know, though, that the month of December did not begin in total futility, but that in fact our good friend Randy, who likes to be the first past the post at the beginning of the month, started out December in spectacular fashion, contributing $250, which he in turn hopes that you will treat as a challenge and meet. Here this evening on the first of the first program of the new month. So that's what we're looking for. And in fact, we could even say that it's only $200 because our buddy Horst sent me a note last night and said, in anticipation of the hole you're probably already in, and took a $50 bite out of matching Randy's kind contribution. So thank you very, very much. Thanks for the updates. Jeremy letting me know the program sounds great on an Android using the TuneIn app. Thank you very much. Marty wants to know, and his driver's test will be as soon as he can afford to pay $600 at a whack for liability insurance and comprehensive and collision. That's when. Now, I've babbled along here just to let you know where we've been. And thanks also to Brian for kicking in. Let's call that $190 instead. Thank you very much, Brian. But I know it's Wednesday. We usually do prayer meeting Wednesday. But a little something's been going on here in the hills and hollers of almost level West by God, Virginia. You know, of course, about the ongoing work with the AIC campaign, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Campaign, and your participation in seeing it get as far as it has gone. Well, Mike Rozelle is a legendary activist working in he was born and raised in Kentucky, but working in the great American West and Northwest, and then coming to Appalachia and beginning to campaign against mountaintop removal. He is truly legendary. Many of the groups that you know and respect for their work in defense of the places where we live, things like the Rainforest Action Network, the Ruckus Society, Greenpeace, all of those organizations, Mike was intimately associated with, and most recently founded something called Climate Ground Zero, or CGZ for short, and. Acting with Climate Ground Zero, Mike recently, well, let's let Mike tell the story. Are you there, Mike?
Yeah, Bob. Thanks for having me on. It's good to talk to you again.
Oh, it's good to talk to you again, brother. I was going to tell folks that you're a legendary activist, that you are a hero to many, but that first and foremost, I count you among my friends.
Well, thank you, but I must correct you. I am not an activist. I'm a campaigner, and there's a big difference.
Well, there is, and I apologize for that.
I suppose all campaigners are activists, but I don't like the label because it seems that a lot of activists are sort of buffet activists, that they choose and pick issues, and they work on them and maybe contribute, but a campaigner actually grapples an issue, has a goal and an objective, and doesn't stop until that objective is achieved. So I prefer to think of myself as a campaigner. I didn't come down here to protest mountaintop removal.
You came down here to end it.
Yes, I came down here with a campaign that was formed, as you know, by the people of Appalachia who set the goals. And, you know, they put the guidelines in, and they invited everybody in to come in and help. And that's when I came down. And I did not come here to organize. I did not come here to train or teach or do anything. I came here to stand with the people of Appalachia who had already been in this fight for a long time.
Well, and indeed it has been a long time in the struggle. Of course, you knew Larry Gibson. You knew Judy Bonds.
Yeah.
You know a lot of the present.
I wouldn't be here without either of them.
Exactly. And you know a lot of the... a lot of the present heroes of the struggle. You're a good friend of mine, our mutual friend, colleague, and comrade, Bo Webb. You know Maria Gonneau. You've worked closely with all of those people.
I think of them as my drinking buddies, but I suppose they're also the allies too. But, you know, we're all one big family down here on the river.
Absolutely, absolutely. And down there on the river, you are where you are is not at all far from a genuine ecological and human rights and human health disaster vis-a-vis mountaintop removal.
Yeah, and even worse than that, you know, because we're on the Coal River, we're right below the sludge impoundments, and really those are the most dangerous things, and every bit of coal, whether it's underground or mountaintop removal, produces a lot of sludge, and this is sitting above those earthen dams, and they're not made well. We know people who have actually worked on them, and they were violating the engineering regulations in doing so.
No, they were blasting next to the one.
Filling 8 billion gallons of sludge could hit the Coal River, then the canal, then the Ohio, and then the New Orleans. You know, so these are the we're not worried about just regional issues here, but really the water that Appalachia, you know, generates from all those storms that come in, you know, is distributed to 2/3 of the people who use fresh water in America. So, you know, this is the headwaters. This is the roof of our country where all the snow and water collects. And if we don't have water coming down those gutters, then we don't have water at all.
Well, exactly. And of course, looking at places like Georgia, who was damn near ready to go to war over a chunk of the Tennessee River, we begin to see the value in that, don't we?
Absolutely. Nothing is more valuable than water. And you never realize that, of course, until your well runs dry.
Or gets poisoned.
Yes.
And that has happened
on the problem up here, of course, as you know, that it's harder and harder to find water to drink.
Oh, we've got a well here, Mike, that my grandmother paid extra. You know, back when they drilled a well, maybe they still do drill a well by the foot.
Mm-hmm.
The deal is they'll drill to the first vein, but she knew that first vein was going to be nasty red, ugh, and had them drill through. You know, I think it's 72 feet deep, this well is. And when I was a child, this was the one thing I looked forward to more than anything else coming here. In addition to my aunt, my grandmother, seeing them, was getting to drink that ice cold, crystal clear water out of that well. And back in the 80s, they blasted the bejesus out of some hills not too far out my road. And ever since then, it's got this viscous red goo that settles to the bottom of it. And it ain't safe to drink.
Right. How many times have we seen this?
Yeah, time after time after time. And so you have witnessed all of this, Mike. And you formed Climate Ground Zero in the company of affected citizens down in the Coal River Valley and other parts of West Virginia.
Well, that's actually not entirely correct. I started Climate Ground Zero out of Missoula, Montana, when I realized that, you know, there was a lot of talk about civil disobedience, you know, working on these inner issues. And civil disobedience requires a lot of preparations and knowledge and logistical and tactical help and some training. And realized that nobody was really doing that. And so we set up our program to organize 1-week-long boot camps, I call them. I don't really do training camps. If you don't get up and make a workshop, we ask you to leave. And you can't bring your dog or your drum. But we do these.
Oh, you mean you're actually working?
Yeah, we call them boot camps because nobody's ever worked at any workshop I ever went to. And you know, we take a very serious approach to this, and what we're trying to locate are those kind of leaders who can organize and execute good actions in a safe and effective way, and one that communicates the message. And so often, you know, people do actions, you know, kind of in a lazy way, and they miss opportunities, and we're just trying to hone their skills. And, you know, in the process, you know, we've probably trained over 1,000 people since 2001 when we began.
And the 2001 beginning was really not a beginning at all, because you've got a whole history of actions behind you.
Yeah, I've been involved in direct action since 1975, and we began Earth First as a direct action organization, and that started in 79, and then I was the first action director for Greenpeace in the U.S. and formed their first action team. We started the Rainforest Action Network because there was no groups in the U.S. that really had campaigns on rainforests. They would talk about them and run pictures of frogs and whatnot, but they had no real campaigns with goals. And we thought, you know, the groups like the Sierra Club, Friends of the Earth, and Greenpeace should have been involved in those, and they weren't. So, you know, most of what I try to do is, you know, find a hole in the line and figure out a way to plug it rather than try to figure out how to organize everybody into doing something that I might think is better than what they might already be doing. So we really focus on our program, and we think that the kind of stuff that we do really is the tide that lifts other boats. And I think this last action that we did really demonstrates the power of that.
And that's the direction in which I am headed. You, of course, have known about, and you are a member of the AHEC team, the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Team. You've been aware, as they've been released, of these damning studies of the health impacts, the negative health impacts of living in a mountaintop removal community or living in peace when mountaintop removal comes to your community. Was it these health impacts that have driven your most recent action?
Yes, indeed. And you know, and I have to give credit to Bo Webb because, you know, he has been saying things around here that were just really almost
prophetic,
blasphemous to, you know, the very comfortable MTR campaigners who were mostly focusing on the Clean Water Act revision, which we all know will not stop mountaintop removal, and we'll have to get our tape measures out and our nets. We'll have to count fish and flies and file appeals, get back into court with these corrupt judges and lose another case. And Bo's bill would actually stop the blasting, and then we wouldn't have to go to court. If they blew off a mountain, we'd take them to jail. And I think that's the only solution. So he had to demonstrate that the health impacts that we all know are happening because we see our people getting sick, we see the babies when they're born. Everyone knows that the mortality rates in our area is the worst in West Virginia, which has the worst mortality rates in the country. So that means we're worse than all those chemical places like Huntington and Charleston, which recently wound up on the bottom of the best cities to live, and that was one of the main reasons. So if it's worse here in the country than by those chemical plants, then something's going on. But no one ever bothered to study it. No one, the state certainly didn't want the information known. They didn't want the studies. The coal companies would never do it. And the federal government was afraid to because they're afraid to buck the state of West Virginia. They cower. They cower in front of them. The EPA will not enforce the laws that they enforce all over the country. They will not enforce them here. So Bo's idea was that if we could get convincing studies to show that this was not just an environmental issue, but really an emergency, a health emergency, and one that really violates the laws. And the other thing was to circumvent all these environmental agencies that have been captured by the coal companies and to get it into the public health agencies who are not so corrupted. And not to say that some of them aren't captured as well, but at least we have a new front, a new way to go and to meet new people and to get sponsors, really based on a whole different approach. And it's proved so effective that our bill now is 10 times more likely to get passed as the Clean Water Act. They've been working on it for 10 years and have spent millions and millions of dollars. We've been working on it for 2 years, and I bet we haven't spent more than $100,000.
If that.
And yeah. You know.
Yeah, I mean,
most of us spend a lot of our own money getting to and from Washington, and it's been very difficult to get the national groups to support this campaign. We now get them to say we like it, but they won't help us do anything, and they refuse to do anything themselves. So, but I tell you how it really got me is the first study done by Michael Hendricks, who came out here with a bunch of Christian college students because we didn't want to use the usual enviros because they would have been turned away from the door. And we drove them. I was one of the drivers. Ed Wiley was one of the drivers. We drove 80 miles of the Coal River and knocked on every single door in the valley. That's a lot of doors. We got 500 hair samples. We got 500 hair samples in Pocahontas County where they don't have mountaintop removal. And we also have questionnaires to ask the people about how many people in their household were sick. And, you know, a lot of people wouldn't open the door. Certainly a lot of coal miners were not going to let us get that close to their head with a pair of scissors. But a lot of people did, and not only did they do that, they called their neighbors. They called their neighbors, and they sent us over to their neighbor's house. So it was really interesting, and that really moved me to sit there and hear these people talking about their family members.
Yeah.
And some of them would be sitting there, you know, and they're sick. You can tell. They're on a dozen medications. And, you know, so it was real. It wasn't, you know,
we
didn't need the results. We already knew. But fortunately, the University of West Virginia and Michael Hendricks, they did this one study, and it was just as we thought. And then there's been more than 20 since then, all confirming. So, and, you know, according to USGS, they say we can't eat the food in our gardens. And that's really when I blew it. You know, I can't grow food very well in my garden. And now I'm glad I didn't.
All right, or to see the...
I'm the only guy in West Virginia that can't grow a tomato.
Man, that's tough. That's tough.
Yeah, but I'm glad I didn't grow them.
Because, you know, along about mid-July, the tomato Jones kicks in here in central Appalachia. And you can see people just, you know, looking at their tomato vines, you know, willing the damn things to ripen.
Yeah.
I'm like that. I absolutely am. Well,
no, we can't live without our tomatoes here, can we?
No. That and, you know, really awesome kick-ass bacon and, well you know, I'm such a meat eater.
These things really move me. And, you know, when you witness, you become involved. That's what Larry always said, you know. And when the first time I met Larry, I went up on Kayford Mountain, and that was my first introduction to this community. I'd been to a meeting in Knoxville, and then was invited down. Up at that meeting, there were college students and professional, environmental, what I call salary suckers, and, you know, all your coordinators and experts and facilitators. But, you know, there was also Bo and Judy and Vivian and Patty and, you know, we know those folks. And they said, well, Mike, you can't learn nothing about mountaintop removal in a meeting like this. You got to come down and visit. And that's when I went up on Cherry Pond Mountain and picked ramps. And now I'm starting to get it. So that
everything changes the minute you see it with your own eyes, doesn't it?
Yeah, and so when I went up to see Larry, you know, I was at his 3rd of July, 4th of July picnic and everything, and so I was hanging around and listening to speeches and good old country music, and he's sitting at a picnic table under the shade, real hot sunny day. He says, Mike, come over here and sit with me under the tree. And I did. He goes, he just looked me right in the eye. He says, well, Mike, now that you know what's going on here, I want to ask you one question. And I go, well, what? He goes, what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Where have you been?
And I couldn't look that man in the eye and say, I'll do what I can. I'll do everything I can. But, you know, that's the way people, you know, Bo and Judy and Debbie and Ed, they've all engaged me that way. You know, it's like, what are you going to do? You know, you think you come down here, you like it, you pick some ramps, you know, you eat dinner, we go on a hike, and then you go back to California or New York, and then we never hear from you again, you know. So they always want to know, what are you going to do? And so I realized that at that point, you know, without even answering the question, I'd already made the obligation that I was going to do whatever I could. And it also fit with the mission of Climate Ground Zero, where, you know, we try to go to the places where, you know, it really is ground zero, where the types of things that happen absolutely have to be stopped if we want to address the climate crisis. But it's, you know, it's about so much more than climate. And so, you know, at that time, I really did make a commitment for life, and that was 10 years ago. And you know, and that commitment is as strong today as it ever was.
And it has come at no small amount of personal sacrifice, Mike. You were the first time over in Raleigh County. You were the first time you were jailed. What was that over, and how long was it for?
Well, that was very interesting. I was in jail for 2 weeks, and against my will, I was bailed out. I was going to sit there till my trial. I was going to have a necessity defense trial, even though they wouldn't allow it, but I know how to do one. You know, I don't mind pitching a foul ball once in a while and hitting a pitcher. But
you got to brush them back once in a while.
You got to do it. And the trial, you know, preparations went on for 2 years. And I kept getting continuances and continuances because, really, we didn't have much of a chance of winning this thing. And I thought the more time I put between the action and the jury, you know, the less heated up they would be. I also thought that in Beckley I might be able to get some kind of a jury with at least one retired underground coal miner that hated Massey on it that would block it. Or, you know, when my attorney says, is that your legal strategy? And I said, well, you got a better one? He says, well, no, actually. And then when we actually got to trial, and when we voir dired the jury, every one of them was had a family member, a close friend, or neighbor in the coal industry, and yet we could not get any of those people kicked off the jury. So I knew that it wasn't going to work, and we had set kind of a little trap by asking for some important information that they knew they were going to introduce on Friday. The trial was on Tuesday, and that Monday was a holiday, so we knew that we wouldn't have it. We complained to the judge. He knew it was a ruse. We asked for a continuance. He was not interested in doing it, but we had to have the, you know, the little conference back in the chambers. And then at one point, the judge left. We were sitting there with the prosecuting attorney, and Roger Foreman looked him in the eye and says, are you your own man? And the district attorney goes, what? He goes, are you your own man? He says, what are you talking about? Or he says, are you Don Blankenship's man? He says, I'm not Don's man. And I says, well, then let's talk. So we got him to get the continuance based on our evidentiary lack of evidence, because we knew what they were going to introduce. It was a file that Massey had prepared that had all our pictures.
Oh, stuff. Yeah, the one that accused you of being basically the Lindbergh baby kidnapper?
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, and there was a lot of guilt by association and bringing in people that didn't need to be bringing in, and they'd already done this in another trial, so they knew they were going to do it, but they'd never sent us a copy, and so that's what, anyway. So he said, okay, I'll agree to the continuance. When Judge Burnside came back in, he was irate, but he had no choice. So even after impaneling a jury, we got a continuance. This never happens. So I walked out of there a free man. And that's when I decided that we were going to try to sit down and come to a deal with Massey, because we had 4 civil suits that they filed against us. We had 2 civil suits that we filed against them. We had the civil suit that Judy had filed, or now her estate had filed, for having been assaulted at the rally in July. And we still had a number of outgoing criminal cases that had not been resolved against the other of the protesters. So we sent a letter to Spillman, Battle, and Thomas, Massey's attorney, their legal firm, and said, let's begin talks and trying to resolve all this. And it took a little while, and we had to give up a little bit. In other words, we had to promise not to trespass on Massey property. And all the charges were dropped, my criminal charges reduced to nothing. The slap suits were just disappeared, and we went back to square zero. And now anybody that wants to go back on, they will face the same charges that they would have before, but it will not involve the other 42 defendants. They'll be doing it alone. And so that otherwise, one person on that injunction could have gotten all the other ones in trouble.
Right, right.
So, you know, I call it a draw.
Yeah.
But when you have a draw with a little group against a big company like Massey, it's a victory.
Sure it is. And with that, with, you know, what Shakespeare said, you know, with past as prologue, that gives folks who do not know you a sense of your tenacity. And so bring us forward to the most recent action, because when we get into the nuts and bolts of that, I'm hoping that people will come away from this conversation that we're having, Mike, with an understanding that West Virginia is not a place where we apply that phrase equal justice under law, or we are a nation of persons and not of laws and not persons, or any
right. The rule of law means that everyone has equal justice under the law. If they don't, then there is no rule of law. In West Virginia, there is no rule of law. All the judges are corrupt. And this was what our friend Daryl McGraw told me when I first asked him to get involved with the slap suit back when they first filed it, when we first got here. He said all the courts in West Virginia are corrupt. And I learned that the hard way, in the preceding years. So when I deal with the courts here, I know I'm dealing with a corrupt system. I treat them with all the respect that the system deserves, but I don't have the trust and faith in justice. And so, you know, you have to approach it a different way when you're dealing with an adversary that lacks honesty and openness or integrity. So in this particular case, I wanted to go into court under very different circumstances where I felt that I could have the moral high ground and the legal high ground and hopefully win one for the Gipper here. So what we decided was that the best thing to do, we want to keep focus on the blasting. And, of course, the blasting means the dust.
And the dust means the negative impacts on human health and human rights.
Right. So we went up to Hell's Gate, where Caford Mountain used to be, and we trespassed on the Patriot coal mine site, and we got what we thought was a pretty good representative sample of the kind of stuff that was falling everywhere. We can't be sure, but it was a pretty good representative sample. And we've got a photo and GPS of where it came, and, you know, it's easy to find, and you won't get a place closer to the blasting than that. And we took that, and actually what we did is we ground it up into dust and sifted it. Because, you know, this stuff was not the stuff that, you know, the finer dust goes the furthest. The finer dust is probably the most dangerous. The closer you live, you get the heavy dust. That stuff you can see. A little bit farther away, you get the other dust. That's the kind of dust I get here. I see it on top of my refrigerator. It's kind of a weird grease. You know, I could write my...
Yeah, like the stuff that's on Bo Webb's apples. And...
That's right, and I have to clean the top of my refrigerator off once a month. And there's this black, greasy stuff up there that I have to use Simple Green to get off. It won't just come off with a normal sponge. I always wonder what this was. I stack my firewood out there. It's white. And then 3 months later, it's brown. And then if I have any at the end of the year, it's black. But it burns better. So that was telling me something. Anyway, so we wanted this dust, and then we wanted to deliver it to the people who are responsible for putting it there. So we got quite a bit of it. We got 10 gallons of it. And so we have it in jars. So my feeling was, how many people deserve get this dust? And so we began by having a vigil at the Capitol steps. That was on Monday, the week of Thanksgiving. And it was very, very cold. But again, McGinnis and I took our banner and we sat on the steps. And we had our dust, and anybody want to talk about it, we talked about it, and people were walking by. And then there was a 6:30 curfew, so we figured, let's violate the curfew and see if we can provoke an arrest, and they'll arrest us with our dust. Well, they ignored us, and they weren't going to enforce the curfew. They were just going to let us freeze to death. So we left. We came back the next day and did the same thing. Only this time we stayed real late at night, you know, up till midnight, figuring, well, they can't let the curfew go that long. And again, they were happy to see us sit there shivering in the dark, and there was nobody there to read our sign. But that really wasn't the point. And I had begun a hunger fast, actually on the Saturday before, because I wanted to make sure I wasn't going to get up in the middle of the night and eat a Twinkie. So by Monday, I had been fasting for 2 days, and I was pretty confident that I could go 9 days because I had done so before. And when I fast, I don't drink smoothies. I drink water, only water, because otherwise I don't really consider it a fast. You can put a hamburger, french fries, and a Coke in a blender and drink it. That doesn't make it die.
Jesus, Mike. Sorry. So yeah. You're right.
So I was just going to drink water. And so on Thursday, I was already on the fourth day of my fast, or fifth day, and so it was Thanksgiving, and we were getting a little irritated that they were always ignoring us, and Ed Wiley said, well, I know one way you can get arrested. He says, you just go over to the governor's mansion and knock on his door. And so, hell, that sounded good. So on Thanksgiving, we went there about 4 o'clock, and I pushed the buzzer, and the little voice came up, hello, can I help you? I says, hi, this is Mike Rozell from Climate Ground Zero. I'm here to deliver a present for the governor. He goes, well, what is it? He says, it's a jar of blasting dust that's known to cause illness, birth defects and death. And he goes, just a second,
sir. Yeah, just a minute.
And I went quiet. And then another little voice came on. I think it was a different person. Sir, can you tell us your intentions here? And I says, yes, I have a jar of blasting dust. It's toxic. It's the stuff that's falling on my garden and makes where I can't eat my tomatoes. And we have studies that show that it causes birth defects, illness, and death. I want to deliver it to the governor. And I says, just a second, sir. We'll be with you. So I was thinking maybe the front door was going to open and I could hand the jar.
No,
I wasn't really thinking that.
You know
so anyway,
better.
The Capitol Police come around the corner. There's about four of them. And these guys are like, you know, the Keystone Cops. And I've got a lot of experience with law enforcement. So they come up and they try to push us around, but we, you know, hold on to our rights, our constitutional rights of free assembly, free speech, the media, all that stuff. My team always knows this, and they don't be pushed around by cops. And so they couldn't move us. And they kept trying to think that we were going to get arrested. They kept trying to tell us that we were violating the law, and yet they kept saying for us to leave. And I said, look, if we're not violating the law, we're not going to leave. So after this went on, I realized that was just a holding pattern for them. They were just trying to keep us until the state troopers came. And then they showed up in force. There was about eight of them. And, you know, they walk over in formation with their hats and everything. And I'd say, hi, troopers, how y'all doing? Good to see you. And they go, what's going on here? And I told them what I told them. I got a blasting dust. It's toxic. It causes premature death, illness, and birth defects. And I'm delivering it to the governor. I want him to test it. He says, I don't think we can let you do that. He says, why? Is it illegal to deliver a present? He says, well, you know, this went on and on. And so I says, well, are we under arrest? He says, no. He says, but we're not breaking the law. He says, no. He says, do we have to leave? I says, well, yeah, you have to leave. And I said, well, I understand that. Anyway, we got all that on video. I can't remember it verbatim anymore. But so I said, well, okay, we'll leave. But before I leave, I want to put this on the porch. And when I said that, I didn't wait for permission. I ran up the steps and put it on the porch, and then I ran back out on the sidewalk. So now they arrest me on the side. Well, first they tell me, go get it. And I says, I ain't going to go get it. He says, no, you have to go get that. I says, you can't make me go get that. And he goes, no, you have to go get it. I says, I am not.
You go get it.
I said, I am not taking this dust back to Rock Creek. And this, and he says, what if I don't do it? Are you going to arrest me? And they said, yes. And so I said, okay, arrest me. And so they took me to the jail. Actually, they took me, the funny part was, they took me around to the back. And now there's about 10 troopers, more than I usually see on any of our actions. And then every once in a while, another bigger, taller, older one would come out, and another one. And they had a copy of the West Virginia law book, you know.
Oh, God, Chapter 61.
And flipping through it, trying to figure out what I did wrong. And one of them would look at a passage, and he'd show it to somebody else. And they'd
that's not it.
And then somebody grabbed the book out of his hand, and they'd look. I think it may be this one. So finally they found two charges to charge me with, but they didn't tell me what they were. They did not tell me what they were. In fact, we didn't find out what they were until 3:30 that morning when they posted it on their website. So,
well, for heaven's sakes, don't keep us in suspense. What were the charges?
Well, it was simple trespass, which carries no jail term, and simple disorderly conduct, which has a maximum of 24 hours in jail and a $200 fine. But I had $20,000 bail for those charges.
Right.
So they take me to the jail. I was actually arrested at 4:20, according to the police record. I thought that was kind of interesting. They probably know me pretty well. So they took and checked me into the jail. So I figured, well, this is going to be just a normal going to jail thing. And now my problem was not being in jail, but trying not to get thrown out. Because I was still on my fast. I had wanted to complete it in jail, more of a symbolic thing really than anything else. And I just wanted to forego Thanksgiving this year and try to, you know, I don't know, do something that would have a little more meaning, at least for myself. And so I was great. I get to spend Thanksgiving in jail. That's great. And I missed dinner. Not that I would eat that food anyway. So they threw me in the drunk tank. And that night I spent with 12 people, in a 12 by 12 room. 12 people.
Jesus.
And they were coming and going. You know, some guy would get drug out. Two guys would get thrown in. One guy would get drug out. This went on all night, clanging doors, could not sleep. And we're like sardines, and when somebody's got to use the bathroom, they got to step over three mats. Large, large gangbangers, large, large hillbilly outlaws, lots of tattoos, a rough bunch. None of these people, it was their first night in jail. And yet, we were so tight amongst each other, sharing our food and stories, and, you know, there was no divide between our races and classes and professions, and, we, you know, what can you do in a cell with no windows, you know? We just sat around and told stories. And it was a very meaningful experience for me because, you know, I meet a lot of West Virginians, but I met some West Virginians there that I would never have met before. And, you know, everybody gets in trouble once in a while. Some of these boys get in trouble a lot more than us. But they're still people, and they're still West Virginians, and they still have, you know, they still care about things. And, you know, they were very interested in hearing about mountaintop removal. Some of them knew more about it than others. Not a single one didn't think that Don Blankenship shouldn't be in jail. I didn't meet a single one. And
no,
they all agreed that mountaintop removal was bad. Most of them didn't know any more about it than a Californian. Because, you know, unless you drive down here, you don't see it. And even if you drive through here, you might not notice it, even if you do see it. You know, like Ed says, it's a painted picture. You know, they put that grass on the flat hill. You don't know that there used to be a mountain 1,000 foot higher there. How can you miss something you never saw before?
Right.
So, but even that, they were not happy about it and agreed with everything I said. And since I was the oldest guy in the cell, they started calling me Pops. You know, and Pops in the jail term, that is an honorary degree. And that means, you know, they defer to me. And I'd been in there long enough and knew enough about jail. It was now I was giving all the young kids counseling on how to go through their arraignments. So anyway, I had more fun in that room. I was in there for 3 days. Now, they kept trying to arraign me.
Well, I was going to say, 3 days, no arraignment? What?
No, see, I didn't want an arraignment. You know, some people thought that they were denying me the arraignment. They wanted to arraign me the first night. That would have been midnight. I mean, they would have kicked me out of jail on Thanksgiving night. In 20 degree weather, and I had no money in my pocket. I wasn't able to make a phone call, and you know, I didn't have anybody give me a ride back to Rock Creek, and I didn't have any place to stay in Charleston. So I would rather spend the night with my buds in the cell than do that. So I refused to go. I said, I'm not going to see the magistrate until I talk to my attorney, and I have to have a phone call. So I hadn't had a phone call. I didn't get one Thursday. So Friday morning, I get my phone call. I call here at Rock Creek. He says, oh, have to have a correct call. But there's supposedly a way you can set it up when you get the call. Well, it turns out Suddenlink is not hooked up at the system. There is no way that Suddenlink can accept a correct call from the jail. So I'm now denied a way to call my home. Now, I don't have my phone book or my cell phone, so I don't have any other numbers. I'm a little dyslexic, and I can't remember a bunch of numbers. So if I can't call my home and tell my family where I'm at, and for them to call my lawyer, I have no communications whatsoever. Well, that was my one phone call on Friday, so I got another one on Saturday. Well, on Saturday, the number still wasn't working. So that was my one call. And then on Sunday, I finally got, I think I got Tom Rist's number, but they wouldn't let me call that one until something like 1 o'clock the next day. And I tried and tried and tried to get my phone call. So after 3 days in the drunk tank, you're not allowed to be in there for more than 72 hours. So right before the 72-hour thing came up, they came in and they almost grabbed me and pulled me out of cells. Mike, you can't stay in there. We got another cell for you. So that's great. As long as I got another cell and they're not throwing me out of jail, I'm happy. Well, little did I know, they were throwing me in the hole. And they took all my blankets except for one thin blanket, no pillow, a plastic mattress, and they turned up the air conditioner. And that was one of the coldest. I've been in the Arctic. I used to go hiking in Yellowstone in the winter, but that was one of the coldest nights I ever spent, Bob. And I hadn't, at this point, eaten in 8 days, and I hadn't slept in 3 days because you can't really sleep in a room with 12 people when the door is clanging and people are coming and going all night.
No.
If you're lucky to get a little shut-eye for a few minutes, but I wasn't. You know, part of it was when you're fasting, sometimes it's harder to sleep. You do have a lot more energy somehow. And so here I'm now in the hole. Can't believe it. But somehow I thought that was a good thing, that they were reacting to me, you know. So I spend a day and a half in the hole, and it's getting later. And then finally, they've been coming into my cells. Mike, we want you to talk to the counselor. Mike, we want you to do this. Mike, we want you to do that. And I said, look, I've told you guys, until I talk to my lawyer, Tom Rist, our friend, I'm not talking to any of you, any of you. And I'm not talking to no magistrate. I am not an inmate. I have not been arraigned. I shouldn't be in a punitive cell because I am not even charged with the crime, much less been convicted. Where is the presumption of innocence? I asked the jailer for another blanket. He says, we can't give you another blanket in this cell. He says, I might be able to get you a sheet. Well, he never did. So if I'm just being held, you know, over for, you know, my arraignment, why am I in a torture cell? And let's ask another question. Why would anyone be in a torture cell? Why would anyone be
any
in a torture cell?
Anyone.
So, and I knew it, and I just, you know, boy, by this time I'm getting really emotional. I haven't had sleep for 4 days, and I haven't eaten for longer, and I'm starting to not really hallucinate, but, you know, I'm high. You could scrape me off the ceiling. And I'm pretty happy about all this. You know, I'm going, wow, it's so nice to get their attention. Little did I know what was going on behind the scenes, and I'll tell you that part of the story in a minute. So finally, the nurse comes in with the big bull and another staff person who I hadn't seen before, and they all sit down, and they go, Mike, have you eaten today? And I said, no, ma'am. And she goes, did you eat yesterday? And I said, no, ma'am. She says, have you eaten anything since you've been in this jail? And I said, no, ma'am. She says, when was the last time you had something to eat? And I told her. It was, at this point, it had been 9 days earlier. And she goes, are you on a hunger strike? And I knew what that word meant.
Right.
And I said, no, I am on a fast for a religious purpose.
Bingo.
And so they left. But then they came back again with two big bulls. And then two nurses, and they said, Mike, we want to take you to the medical facility. And I didn't know what to do there. If I resisted, it would have made it look like I belonged in the medical facility, you know. You know, I wasn't able to take care of myself. And they said they put me in the tank for health, you know, because they were worried about my health. Well, if they were worried about my health, why couldn't I get two blankets instead of one?
Oh, yeah, that doesn't wash.
No, they can control the temperature in the cells in these jails to the very degree. I figured this out because I'd been in enough of those cells already. And, you know, and I'll tell you another story about the next cell I went into, because if you think the hole was bad, the next one was in a way somehow worse. So they took me to the medical unit and sat me down and said, Mike, we're really worried about your health. I said, worried about my health? I'm healthier than most of you people. You know, they were all obese. You know, and I said, I have plenty of energy. My mind is clear. I know exactly what I'm doing. And I want to talk to my attorney, and I'm not going to talk to you people until I talk to my attorney. And I says, I'll remind you one more thing. I am not an inmate. You can't do anything to me in this unit because your insurance doesn't cover it. Until I have been checked into this jail, you can't touch me. You know, and I was almost ready to have him stick the hose up my nose, you know. Alice Paul did it and, you know, made history. But I figured, well, you know, they don't have a right to do it. They're not going to, you know, and I also thought they might be bluffing. So at this point, I wanted to show some form of cooperation, that I was rational, that I wasn't self-destructive, and that I was suffering no ill effects from the fast, because they couldn't tell how high I was. Or maybe they could, but they don't really know me. But I was just feeling in a really, really good mood. I had a lot of energy. And I felt more determined than ever that I was going to beat these people. So the next step is they put me in the suicide prevention cell. Took all my clothes, gave me a pair of orange panties.
And why?
And a blue suicide smock that came halfway to my knees and had no shoulders. They put me in cell number 3 right in front of the booking desk, which has a glass window. They took my mattress again and no blanket this time. No blanket this time. And I stood in that room until 1:30 that night with no mattress. And you know what I decided to do? Sometimes I try to sit down on the bed. It was all concrete, but it made my legs cold because my skirt was a little short. I normally wear a knee-length skirt. When I'm
Right, yes. You've got this fabulous
really high,
legs.
You know? But so it was really awkward. So finally I just decided I'm going to lay down on this cold concrete slab, and I'm going to get hypothermic on him. I'm just going to see it. And I thought of myself as a samurai, you know, because it actually if you don't think of it as a dress, it looks a little bit like a samurai armor. Yeah. You know, it's all quilted.
Yeah, you are a Ronin, man.
So I laid that on there, and everybody can see because that was the whole point. They were trying to humiliate me, right, putting me in a dress. I had these nice pumps on. No, they were sandals with toeless sandals. But so I just stood there pretending I looked really good in my dress, and then I laid down until my teeth were chattering so loud that they could hear it across the desk. Well, all of a sudden, I could hear this noise, and then heat was coming out of the vent. So finally, for the first time in a week now, I'm warm. I'd been shivering almost every day since I was there. And the warmest I was is in the holding tank, but even there we were cold because they would turn up the cold because they'd know there were so many of us. And so I didn't have any sleep up even till then. So now I'm supposed to be arraigned 8 o'clock in the morning that morning. And I wait in my dress and my cold room for 5 hours. The clerk goes an hour over. My name does not get called. So then I go back. I have now to wait to 8 o'clock in my cell, in my dress. But at least they'd given me a plastic mattress and a suicide blanket, which was like my dress, way too short. Way too short. So I had to curl up.
Feeling. I'm sorry I laugh, but...
Yeah, but, you know, it's hard to get comfortable in that shit. I may look good in it, but I don't feel good. So this goes on all the way to 1:30. Now, I've got my support team out for the second time waiting for me for my imminent release, which they had said, you know, once I agreed to be arraigned. So at 1:30 at night, they say, we're not going to do it. We're going to do it in the morning. So by this time, I'd eaten two meals because I didn't want them to have an argument that I was self-destructive. They were going to send me to a mental institution. They were going to stick a rubber hose up my nose. We know all this now because that way they could discredit me. You know, I had gone crazy. You know, they had to deal with me to protect me.
Yeah, stir crazy in the stir.
So. So I knew this, and I figured, oh, now I'm in the most dangerous part of the game. So then, you know, 8 o'clock comes around for the next session. It goes to 1:30, nothing. Next morning, 8 o'clock, we start again. The clock stops. And I didn't get arraigned until 1:30. All right? Now, during this entire time, yesterday morning, I am standing in the lineup with all these other ex-cons and cons and pre-convicts, and we're not allowed to move between the yellow line, and we're standing there. Now, they know I haven't eaten now for 9 days, and I've only had two of the jail meals, which are not very healthy, you know, not very healthy. And they weren't giving me any fluids. For 5 hours, I was not allowed to get a drink of water. So if they were so concerned about my health, why did they make me stand in line after all that when I was supposed to be released the morning before? And the nurses would walk by and not even look at me. And I think I know why. They were ordered to do this. All these orders came from up above. As it turned out, Mike Sharon, our cameraman, who was there all this time the last 2 days while I was supposed to be in the rain, you know, three sessions, each 6 hours, 18 hours, he was there. He goes out on the smoking porch to smoke. Now, out there is also all the employees of the jail smoking. They all smoke. And he's a canvasser and a gift of gab. He's a New Yorker. And he talked to them a lot. And he found out that they're very mad about staff cuts, underpay, overwork, and their bosses are all assholes. So they actually supported me. You know, they supported me. And everybody in that jail, by the time I left, knew my name and had an opinion about me. And I would say half of them were good, and a very small amount would be negative, and you'd have to go pretty far up the food chain to hear those. No one had ever stood up to these bastards before. But I'll tell you what I saw is how poor people get treated in West Virginia. that really upset me. And the big thing is the phone calls, right? If I can't make a fucking phone call, excuse me.
That's okay. It's the internet. You can do that.
Okay?
Yeah.
If I can't make a phone call, and I know how to do this, and I didn't find out to the last minute that Suddenlink doesn't hook up to their jail. You know, it used to hook up to the Southern Reach, where I had been before, and the Southwest Eastern Reach. Anyway, so the game is rigged against people. Now, the convicts, the people in jail, they don't pay for those calls. Their families do.
Yes.
And most of them people are poor.
So they pay a princely ransom for those collect calls, too, Mike.
On a phone call are the people who can least afford it, and the people who need to make those phone calls are the most desperate in need of a phone call. And it costs me nothing to call Charleston from my house on my Suddenlink. I get unlimited long distance all the way to Canada and Mexico for one simple price. So they can't be costing them for this stuff. They're just trying to take every bit of money anywhere they can.
It's a hustle.
It'd be okay if they'd serve a little bit better food, but we got fed some of the worst food I ever saw. And this whole experience has caused me to want to be a jail reformer, and I'll go into that part in a little bit. So I finally get to the arraignment and get out, and only after getting out do I realize that the hospital switchboards were getting a couple of hundred phone calls a day from all over the world. Governor Tomlin got thousands of phone calls from all over the world. Free Mikey. and test that damn dust while you're at it. So it turned out that while I was in there, I was totally isolated. I didn't know nothing. You know, a tsunami could have taken out Miami. I wouldn't have known it. And when I got out, there was this overwhelming support that I had seen, not just for me, but for the AIC campaign. And
Jeff Biggers wrote a magnificent piece.
Yes, yes, yes. Boy, he can crank them out quick, can't he?
Well, when you're that brilliant a wordsmith, I guess it's just like breathing air.
He's the Stephen King of environmental journalism. He can get one out every day. So yeah, I was very appreciative of all the support I got, and without it, I think I could have been lost in that system, you know. Because when you start to do non-cooperation, you go up to very serious risks. And the first thing they want you to do in jail is to give away, one by one, your Miranda rights. And I refuse to surrender a single one of them. But the most important one is right to counsel. And it helped that it was Thanksgiving holiday. It was hard to reach people and blah, 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 blah. But the fact was I wanted to stay in jail till my fast ended on Monday, and I did. I was ready to leave on Monday, but they messed up my paperwork, and I had to stay another day and didn't get out till Tuesday at 1:30. And so that's kind of my experience in the West Virginia jail system, and I feel very, very good about it because we have so much evidence of lack of due process, lack of counsel, lack of phone calls, punitive treatment of an unconvicted or even uncharged criminal, arrestee, and outright torture. Come on.
Yeah.
I didn't sleep for five nights. I finally, on the sixth night, got a little bit of sleep, but I had to sleep in that smock, and I didn't sleep that well because they still kept the cold on. They were just trying to, you know.
Well, this was Hillbilly Gitmo, Mike.
Yes. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine in Turkey over the internet. You know, this story has gone all over the world because, you know, working for groups like Greenpeace and such, you know, I have a friend, a network of international activists who also have their own social networks. And I'm getting messages from all over the world, even Russia. But, you know, a friend of mine checked in from Turkey and says, our jails are better than that. Only recently you could drink beer, but you can still smoke cigarettes and they serve coffee. Well, they haven't served coffee in West Virginia jail for at least 10 years, you know, and that used to be one of the only pleasures of being in jail is getting at least a warm cup of coffee in the morning. Well, we don't even get that anymore. So, I think...
Yeah, and you do not want to read the ingredient label for that prison cheese. You do not.
No, I would like to read it. One of the great things about being on a fast is I love...
It's nothing but vegetable oil, Mike.
Yeah, it's not. There's totally vegan, and they have things that look like hot dogs. They have things that look like bologna. Any kind of meat you want, they've got stuff that looks like it. But I think it's all made up textured vegetable protein. They used to give you the cheese, Now we don't even get the cheese.
Really?
They've cut the cheese out of it. We used the last time.
You know, when Appalachian
the sandwich, we also got the piece of fake cheese.
When Appalachian jails have quit giving out government cheese, you know that you pretty much hit rock bottom.
It's not government. It's Cisco cheese. It's GMO cheese. There's not any dairy product in the cheese.
No, there really isn't.
And I would like to see the ingredients, but it's just solidified oil with food coloring.
You know, this predates your arrival in West Virginia, but back in the days when counties still had jails in this state,
mm-hmm.
Before the rise of these industrialized regional jail monstrosities, people would go for miles around to have lunch at the McDowell County Jail. It was the best food to be had in 50 miles. I mean, they had a brilliant cook down there, and it just was.
You know, you can make good food from simple ingredients. And even the ingredients they're using in these jails, if they had some skilled people in the kitchen, could be made edible. But, you know, the biscuits could not be eaten. Even the
play hockey with them.
Stuffing them. Yeah, I mean, you could talk about jail food all you want, but I usually don't complain about the food. You know, we're all eating the same thing, and we just complaining is not going to make it any better. But
all we got in common is our misery, so the least we can do is share it. Right.
Because, you know, it's really affecting the people who can least afford to deal with it. You know, people who are already having a hard time eating before they get in there. And now when they get in there, this food, I don't think it's healthy. And it's all GMO.
Would you agree with me, Mike, when I say that based on your most recent experience, that it is safe to say that this state and largely this country, I've said this a number of times on this program, has a punishment fetish?
Yeah. Well, any institution that is given punitive powers will abuse them, and you know, especially at the lower level, they found. You know, that it's very, very easy to create a torturer. You know, a lot easier than you
think. Oh, yeah.
And just give them the power, and eventually, you know, they did those tests with college students, and they would torture each other in experiments, and some of them had to be called off because they started torturing each other really bad. And these were college students. Anyone could be turned into a monster. It's the institution that does it. And so you got to look at these institutions. But, you know, right there in the front page of my jail handbook, it says, we believe in treating prisoners humanely. Now, I would like to ask you how humane this is. Putting a person on suicide watch who loves life as much as I do is ridiculous. Someone who is healthy as I am and obviously alert, you know, I could answer all their questions. You know, I could name every monarch of Babylon, you know, going back to Cyrus the Great. It's just absolutely absurd. They were just trying to find a way to put me out of action.
Yeah.
And they kept getting meaner and meaner and meaner, even up until the very last minute. And little did I know that switchboard had been ringing the whole time I was there, and that's why they were mad at me, because they felt I was, you know, going after them. And
well, there was a spotlight shining on them. But
yeah,
let's
would have been the right time to treat me nice, you'd think. But they went the total opposite direction. But they didn't know who they was messing with until later.
Well, I'm not in the least surprised, Mike. Let's take something you said a moment ago and expand upon it within the realm of mountaintop removal. You said that anybody can be turned into a monster. It is the institution that does it. Is that transferable to mountaintop removal and the coal industry in and of itself? And I ask you this because I think about all the people who go to work on mountaintop removal sites, blasting away, poisoning water, poisoning people, spreading cancer like jam across toast. And if you sat any one of them down and said, you know, would you willingly do this? Wouldn't the answer immediately be hell no?
Well, you know what happens, and I do get to talk to a lot of these guys because I go to family dinners here on the river on holidays and stuff, and I'll sit down with a couple of strippers, and you know, we don't talk too much over the table. But one thing Bo told me, and I found that it's really true, is that surface mining is a cult, especially if you work for a company like Massey, now Alpha. And that is, you know, the definition of a cult is you believe that you have the right view, everybody else has the wrong view, and that you're constantly being attacked by them. And this creates kind of a solidarity amongst them, a camaraderie, you know, people who do it together. They know everybody hates them. And so they read the book. You know, they have the faith. They swallow the Kool-Aid. It's the only way. That's why do they put all these death head stickers on their truck? You know, it's a cult of death. Why do they walk around with
the cross?
When a little bit of Gojo would wipe it off their face. Why do they sit down at Christmas dinner at the grandma's house and have coal on their face? I'd have been slapped if I had just a little bit of mud on my face when I was young. Why do they do that? You know, because it's a cult. And that's why the trucks, that's why the stickers, that's why they wear their stripes out everywhere. They want to be identified with their cult, and they know that everybody hates them, and they don't care because they all love each other.
I think you distilled it to perfection, Mike. With everything that has gone past in the last couple of weeks, first of all, what happened to the dust?
Well, they instructed my cameraman to take it, and when I was in the car riding over to the jail, I said, you know, you guys really blew it. He said, what? I says, you just let my cameraman walk away with the evidence. And I says, I really wasn't disorderly, and I wasn't trespassing, so you guys are in big trouble. And I told him another thing. I says, you guys don't realize this, but you just hooked a big fish. And he says, I don't know if you're going to be able to land them, and I'll just bet you won't. But you can look me up and find out. But you have just unleashed hell on yourselves. And they
went, oh, hell, you're lucky you didn't get charged with threatening an officer out of that.
I didn't worry about that. But great. Give me another charge. But so then the officer in his police report, which I don't know if you haven't read, but you should read, the last part he says, and Roselle said that he wanted to get arrested, that he was going to be in the news the next day, and then he was going to sue us. And guess what? That's exactly what we're going to do. We're preparing a very big lawsuit against the jail for false arrest, false imprisonment, inhumane conditions, denial of counsel, and that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning. And lying and saying they put me in a cold, dark cell with a single blanket and freeze my butt off because they were concerned about my health. And they were so concerned about my health, they let me stand in line without being able to sit for 5 hours without asking me if I needed a glass of water or a sandwich, and I missed my lunch. You know, how is that concerned about my health?
Yeah, not so much.
We have so much evidence on them because they were so sloppy because they're so used to doing this and not anyone calling them on it. You know, I'm lying in this cell with these great big hillbilly outlaws, with these great big gangster guys, you know, all these people, they talk all so tough, you know. And yet when the jailer walks into their cell, oh, please, can I use the phone? Oh, please, can I do this? Oh, please, can I do that? They're not so tough. They're not so tough under those situations. And when they saw that I was running these guys out of my cell with my little friend Miranda, they couldn't believe it. I said, how do you do that? I says, that's just the way I do things. So they started calling me Pops. And they all love me. I mean, I've met better people in that cell than I did in the rest of the jail. And I don't know any of their names, and I may not see any of them again, but I'll never forget them.
Well, going back to the dust itself, Mike, that tells me a lot that the governor of the state of West Virginia was so water-boweled with terror that he wouldn't that he could not countenance having the blasting dust that he supports having poured over countless numbers of innocent West Virginians, even within the proximity of the public housing in which he lives.
Yeah.
So,
but you know what? He got over 2,500 calls from around the world while I was in jail on that subject, and everyone knows it now. And there's a lot more heat on him. And I've engaged this international network now, and I'm starting to solidify it. And you know, we were thinking making this a national campaign. I think we can make it even an international campaign now. I got people in New Zealand, and Turkey, and Russia, and Europe. All following this story right now. And what can we do? What can we do? And they called the governor long distance from their countries. So, you know, this is not something that normally happens in West Virginia. Usually we have to fight by ourselves. When people come in and say they're fighting for us, usually it means they want to say hi, get one of our hillbillies and give them an award somewhere, raise a bunch of money, and spend it on themselves. And we've seen it over and over. We've always been alone. You know, so we've got to figure out how we can build these types of allies outside West Virginia, and how we can also, you know, by example, show that if West Virginians stand up for themselves, they can get justice. Because a lot of times they've done it and they haven't. But that doesn't mean they should stop. You know, so part of our campaign is to try to show that there is hope, but it's not going to be easy. Sacrifices are going to have to be made. We can't be afraid of the cops. We can't be afraid of the jails. Martin Luther King wasn't afraid of the jails. All other people are. They want to be out of their little action, you know, by 5 o'clock having pizza, and then they want to raise bail money. When I did this action, I said, do not, under any circumstances, raise a nickel for my bail. I will either stay there or I will get it reduced to zero. Well, I went from 20,000 to zero. We didn't need to raise any bail money. And people have to learn how to continue the non-cooperation into the jail system. We teach that. But nobody that wants to do it anymore. They think nonviolence is a spectacle, that if they don't get in the newspaper, that they didn't do a good action. Well, we didn't get in the newspaper either, not until we got into the jail. And then we started getting the newspaper. Finally, Ken Ward Jr. writes an article. Finally. You know?
Yeah.
And, these are the types of things that people were inspired by, that, you know, while they were having their Thanksgiving dinner, and these are people I know, or people who know me or about me, and they were having their Thanksgiving dinner, and then they saw what I was doing, and it made them think, and then it made them act. And I think, you know, in a way, it changed them. It transformed them. And now I know I can depend on those people who contacted me. I have their contacts. I get back to them. And so the next time we have some person in jail, we have a support network. We can help them out.
Well, you know,
we've
you've
done this when we had people in jail. And remember when our tree sitters were being assaulted?
Absolutely.
You know,
and they were assaulted from the moment they entered the trees.
Yeah.
Those weird ass noise machines and
Yep. And we finally got them to stop it because we gave them a million phone calls. Well, not a million, but you know, a lot more than they're ever used to.
And you know what? You're having a lot of resonance with folks listening, Mike. Our buddy Irish Dave just sent me a note under the subject line cults and said, "Yeah, cults such as Joseph Wambaugh's the New Centurions, yeah, the siege mentality."
Yeah, yeah, they feel like they're under siege, and that's the only thing that keeps the cult together, is the mutual self-protection from, you know, a hostile world. And, you know, they're the keepers of the truth, and no one else has it, so it's important for them, you know, to protect it. And so that way they don't question it. They take it on faith. You know, anything you can say about a cult, you can say about these strip miners.
Yeah, absolutely. Jack in Shreveport says, Mike, under the subject jails and the poor, as I listened to your discussion tonight, I thought of what I heard on my AM radio today, along with some other typical right-wing talking points. If you think about what we've heard from the right-wing talkers about people that are on welfare, recall elements of what Mike said. Why are the hardworking Americans who pay their taxes paying for these people to have Obama phones? Why should these people get color televisions? These people have air conditioners. These people are getting lobster on food stamps, i.e., why should the poor be able to eat anything but the most disgusting processed foods? Jack says, well, you get the idea. And and I know you do, Mike.
Yeah, actually, our family was issued the first series of food stamps back in, it must have been 67 or something like that, when they first came out. We were on welfare before that. I grew up on welfare. You know, I was in an orphanage for 2.5 years, and I left home at 17, and, you know, I've always been poor, and I've never wanted to be anything else. In the neighborhood I grew up, we looked down on rich people, and nobody envied the middle class because we felt that we had more freedom. We may not have money, but, you know, we had more fun, you know, kind of like in that movie, The Titanic, where the party down below was a lot more fun than the party up above. And it's just true with poor people. They share more. They care more. You can depend on people. You know, they depend on each other. And it's just
it's actually a matter of community building, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And you'll find a lot more community among the poorer you go, the more community you will find. I remember one time in San Francisco this summer, I had just completed a rock job I'd been working on for a couple of weeks, and I got $1,000 cash, right? So I'm feeling fully plush, and I'm walking down the Mission. I'm getting ready to you know, go to a nice restaurant, have a beer, not expensive restaurant, but, you know, a nice one.
Yeah.
And I, there's this corner, and there's, like, homeless people in all four corners, but I'm walking on this corner. And so I didn't have any change, so I just give the guy a $20 bill. I figure, well, you know, I can afford it, and I'm not going to give any more money out tonight, so it'll average out. Well, when he got the $20 bill, he raised his hand, look what we got. And the people on the other three corners rushed over, and they shared that $20 bill.
Yeah, what we got. Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't his bill. They took turns staffing that corner, and they pulled all the money they made on it. It didn't belong to the one person.
Well, you know, I have, and then I have you to thank, Mike, for making what was, you know, my only couple of days ever out in San Francisco a much more meaningful experience. Going out, you know, going out to the top of Mount Tam and going for a little wander out in Muir Woods. It was
the oysters.
Oh well, yeah, Swan's Oyster Depot, please. Oh yeah. But the whole point is you introduced me to people out there who shared that same sense of community, and
yeah,
and it's a beautiful thing to behold when you get out somewhere where the idea of not shitting where you live becomes actually an operational philosophy as opposed to something that should be debated over the greater good of, say, Kevin Crutchfield's ability to buy a new jet this year.
Yeah. And, you know, and community is really made by the little actions you take every day. It's not a big abstract construct or some kind of a strategic plan, you know. You create community by the – and I learned this in West Virginia, where even, you know, my neighbor, who my first action I chained down to his excavator, I came back here, he just laughed, you know. He said, they paid us for the day anyway. And he brought me a leg of venison shortly after that, you know. I mean, people here build that community through the little actions they do for each other every day. And, you know, they can cross over those areas where they don't disagree. You know, they're from different churches or families that don't like each other or whatever. And
often they don't like each other over something that happened 100 years ago.
You only had a couple of days there, and you really have a hard time finding that sense of community in anywhere in California that I found here. And when I you know, I was gone for not quite a year, and most of that was on the road. And I found that really now that was paying off. I was wondering if I was doing the right thing. You know, I'd be speaking in rooms with 12 or 14 people, you know, going around, knocking on doors that wouldn't get opened. I tried for 9 months to get a meeting with Mike Bruin, who used to work for me, by the way, and he would never return my phone calls.
And that's an ongoing problem. I've mentioned it on this program. I was trying to calculate earlier today how many days it has been that the Sierra Club has hung the 8 campaign out to dry by refusing to support either the bill or the effort to get the bill passed.
Well, I got a little anecdote you might enjoy. On Thanksgiving Day, Mike Bruin, our Sierra Club director, posted a little post saying that he and his family were flying back from the most wonderful Thanksgiving dinner. And then my post went up where I was drinking water in a dark cell. And so he actually wrote something about, you know, free Mike Rozelle later. So he knows the reason he didn't meet with me, and, you know, him and I are good friends, and I've held his baby in my lap. You know, I've been to his house many times. But
oh, I saw you hold his baby in your arms in San Francisco.
Yeah, and, you know, this time around he kept his distance, and just like Marianne Hitt, you know, I just saw her Lincoln celebrating 5 years with Sierra Club. That means 5 years she hasn't been working on mountaintop removal. And I used to talk to this woman once or a week or once every other week for the last 10 years, and we haven't spoken since. This is what happens when you get into the club. That's another cult. That's another cult. It's not quite as closed as that. Maybe the cult is too strong a word. But, you know, when people said, oh, Mike Bruin, he got hired at Sierra Club, you know, he's going to run it. And I said, no, he just got swallowed by a whale, you know, and now he's given empty suits a bad name.
Well, you know, this is an ongoing question. It's not just the Sierra Club. It's a lot of the big greens who have not, you know, we've got one friend among the so-called big greens, and Earth Justice has been of tremendous help to us from the very, very get-go, and they are amazing people.
both past and present.
Yeah,
but there, yeah. There's a lot of others that, you know, not so much.
No, what they want to be associated with the issue. They want their members to think that they're working on the issue, but, you know, really their policy is driven by their development department. I've been in these meetings. I've run these organizations before. I understand they could care less about a campaign. They're like doctors that see so many patients that they have no empathy for any. You know, is all they want to do is fix it as best they can and get them out the door. Well, in this case, it's not even that good because they don't even want to heal them. You know, they don't even want to heal them.
Right.
They want to get them out the door. But, you know, they put all these things up on how many victories they've had on mountaintop removal, how coal has been beaten. Well, we know that's not true in Appalachia. And it sends such a wrong message that it makes it hard for us to get support. I was talking to a member of a foundation in New York just about 3 weeks ago, and he called me to say, what's going on? He says, well, I thought mountaintop removal was winding down. I says, well, it's winding down from historically high levels, but that just means it's back to the normal high level. The normal high level.
Right, and as I've said before, if we were to shut down every coal-fired power plant tomorrow, the mountains would continue to blow up here in Appalachia because of the vibrancy of the export market.
Things. And it's really fracking that's shutting these down. They're taking credit for shutting down. You know, I think the coal plants like it when the Sierra Club start harassing them, because that way they can cancel their coal contract, go to gas, and save money, and then not be in as much.
And blame it on the tree huggers.
Yeah, blame it on the tree huggers. And then the Sierra Club says, oh, we're winning. And we're not winning nothing. And they don't even have a plan to win, and they don't even care if they win, because really what's important, the larger the institution, the self-preservation of the institution becomes the number one goal. That's true for Greenpeace USA. And so they won't do anything that. Small organizations, they don't care, because if you blow up their office, if you steal all their machines, if you take all their phones, they just meet together at another kitchen table, and the work goes on.
And that's where the work gets done, Mike.
All of it gets done there, and you know that. And then when we get
and then the big green sends out the fundraising email.
And they have their consultants and their media people, and they form their alliances. And you know, if we ever join another alliance, we should be shot.
Have our heads examined.
That's the first step of co-option. And then there's so many reasons. Every time a hillbilly says, hey, let's do this, oh, no, we can't do that. You know, as if we don't know anything and they know everything. And yet I know these people in Washington. Most of them have never passed a bill, never won a campaign. They just work on things. And it's, oh, we're going to work on fracking, and then now we're going to work on XL, and next we're going to work on God knows what. But, you know, they never work on anything to a conclusion. You know, Alice Paul was able to get the Voting Rights Act for women passed because that's all they worked on. And they worked on it every day, and they worked on it as hard as they could, and they were never going to stop until they got it. Now, that's an organization as opposed to an institution. Now, you take the National Organization for Women. They were useless during that struggle. They had conferences with thousands of high society women, and yet they had zero political power. And Alice Paul's National Women's Party was very small and very underfunded. And yet they were the ones that passed the bill. And yet when the bill was passed, guess who took all the credit? The National Organization for Women. And that's what I told Bo. I says, you'll know that this campaign succeeds that when the Sierra Club takes credit for doing all of it.
Absolutely. And then
we just won our bill. We don't give a shit who gets credit.
And there will be a flurry of emails saying, because you've seen them and I've seen them too, Mike. Send us $15 today, and we'll send you a genuine Sierra Club messenger bag so you can help us fill in the blank. End mountaintop removal,
right,
save
right,
the wolves,
right.
Save the Venezuelan Vestal
yeah.
Virgins. You know,
yeah. It's not an honorable way to make a living. It is not an honorable way to make a living, and that's why I don't consider myself a professional environmentalist. And I, you know, some of them are my dear friends, and I, you know, I'm not being... hopefully boastful or anything here, but I have trained most of those people. If you look at the executive directors of most of the big greens, they have trained under me. They have trained under me. But they have forgot everything I taught them, because the more expensive suit that somebody puts on, the less they can remember.
Well, look, Mike, at the end of the day, I hate that phrase. Let me rephrase. In the final analysis, and I have said this before, I think I've even said it to you, the executive director of a big green is not going to die with a weed eater in his hand trying to clear the brush on what's left of a mountaintop at Tayford. The executive director of a big green is not going to die of coal-derived cancer that has eaten up her body like it did Judy Bonds. Okay? It ain't going to happen.
No.
The families are not going to sweat the health care. And I know that sounds halfway shitty to say, but it's a reality, isn't it?
No, it needs to be said, and it needs to be said more. And everybody, this whole thing about, oh, we can't end fight, we can't criticize each other. Well, I never believed that. The reason we started Earth First is because I didn't like the Sierra Club. You know, we wouldn't have needed to start the Earth First if the Sierra Club had been doing their job. In fact, a lot of the stuff that we did, like filing lawsuits, they could have done, and they didn't. They only came in later when we made front page news out of it.
Well, you mentioned lawsuits, Mike. Let me ask you this. We see these lawsuits that they support, and give them credit where credit's due, they support them. But these lawsuits are over technicalities inside the Clean Water Act that do things like provide attorney's fees, and then after the and they're automatic winners. They're
it's a low hanging fruit strategy.
They're dealt with by summary judgment. They seldom go to a jury trial. They put in consent decrees. They pay a few million dollars, and then the mountaintop removal keeps going.
Yeah, and they know this. You know, if they really wanted to send lawyers down here, we could do it. And you know, when I tried to get the Center for Biological Diversity down here. Now that's a big green. They started with $5,000 that I gave them in 1986, you know, and I know most of their staff members very well. And I said, you can't throw a rock in West Virginia without hitting an endangered species. What are you guys doing down here? He says, oh, we don't want to come in with no spotted owl thing. Well, hell, it was the spotted owl that did whatever it did to save the forest. And no one wanted the spotted owl in Oregon, none of the locals, none of the nationals. I had to do it myself. In fact, it was a group in Boston that actually filed the suit. And when that happened, all the others had to join the suit, or else if it got lost, everybody lost. And these guys, they didn't even have the legal work. And it was really funny. So we won the suit.
Well, I know what...
We could have won the suit 10 years earlier if we'd have filed it. And they didn't want to file it because they thought it might lead to the revocation of the Endangered Species Act. And it didn't.
Well, let me say this. I know what the internal working strategy is of the 8 campaign, you know, having been there from the moment that it was founded. And Bo and I talk quite a bit about it. But from the aspect from which you're coming at it, these actions that bring direct attention to the human health torment that is taking place. Unless it's something you can't divulge, where do you after this horrific engagement, where do you go next? What's next?
Well, we're not done. You know, my contribution to the team, I always told Bo, you know, and he took me to Washington, and I had my suit tailored and shined my shoes, and you know, we spent 3 days walking the halls. And you know, and I said, Bo, this is just not the best place for me, you know, and it wasn't. And so my job is to try to raise the profile of the blasting issue. That's the best thing I can do for AIC. And whenever I do it, I also mention the AIC Act. Now, I can't support it because I'm not, you know, it's a legislative, I mean, I can and I can't, but, you know, so I tried to do it in a way that if I do something really... If something goes really wrong, that I don't bring shame on the campaign, because I'm not, you know, our Climate Ground Zero campaign is civil disobedience. That's what we do. But I think civil disobedience ultimately is about education. And I always say that every good campaign is a three-legged stool. There's legislation, litigation, and education. And sometimes one leg is already well established, but without three, it won't stand. So
yeah, otherwise, you know, it's a pogo stick.
Get the laws we have enforced. If we don't have good enough laws, let's get the new laws. That's legislation. And education is direct action in anything that helps alert the public to the problem. But in my experience, nothing educates the public like a good direct action campaign. And most of the campaigns we see today that are direct action campaigns, I don't consider them to be very good. It's a waste of time, a waste of money, and the media doesn't pay any attention. And the reason is because they're spectacles. You know, they just want to get a little newspaper ink. A direct action campaign is much, much more than that. They have to be coercive. The media often doesn't even matter. Sometimes it takes a long time for the media to figure it out. If you think you failed just because they didn't show up the first day, when they didn't show up to my first press conference when we started this action on Monday. You know, we finally got them there on Tuesday. But only one of the media, three media people that were there filed a story. That was the Daily Mail. That's the Cole paper.
Yeah.
They actually ran a pretty good story. None of the others would. So I didn't care because we have an escalation strategy because that's part of a direct action campaign. You can't just do one action and walk away, and you can't do the same action twice. You've got to escalate. That's why we went to the governor's door. That was an escalation. And if that didn't work, I was going to escalate again. I'm not sure what I would have done, but I think my next step would have been to dump it on the floor of the rotunda. They would have definitely arrested me for that. So I was going to get arrested one way or the other, and I was just going to take my baby steps. And I also wanted to make sure that people understood that I was slowly engaging, I was slowly ramping it up, so that I wasn't being brash, I wasn't being irrational, that there's a narrative to this story, that there's a goal and objective, and then now that I've achieved it, when you look back, people go, wow, you know, I did everything I said I was going to do. And that's how you do an action. And people are inspired. That's the word I get on my Facebook page. I don't know if you've looked on it, but I've gotten thousands and thousands of comments.
Yes.
It took me all day to scroll through them. And that's the word I heard most, inspiring, inspiring. And that's what we need to do. We need to motivate and inspire. Education is good, but education alone is not good. They need to be educated and inspired and motivated.
And hear, hear.
And I think we're beginning to do that. I think the aid campaign has been doing that because of his doggedness. And, you know, the work that Bo does in D.C., he is probably right now, even with the little experience that he has, probably one of the best environmental lobbyists in Washington, D.C. And one of the reasons is he listens to people that know things, and he learns things, and he applies those things. And also, he never gives up. And these other guys quit at 5 and go to cocktail parties, not Bo. You know, he's dogged on it.
No, I've been there. I've seen it. He's up at four o'clock in the morning, through the day.
Like the way he works, but when I watch him, I'm in total awe of his determination, his ability, and just his way to figure out how to get stuff done. So I like working with the AIC team because, you know, it's a volunteer organization. We don't have many meetings. We have a clear objective.
Nobody's on salary. Nobody's on staff.
To win.
Yeah.
Nothing else is acceptable.
And
we're not going off to fracking after this, and we're not going to go up to the tar sands after this until it's done.
Well, if you, anything else, and you have diluted your own effort.
Right.
The people who are part of the AIC campaign, founding group, I guess would be the best way to describe it, are the people who are actually affected by mountaintop removal.
Absolutely. They don't live near a ski area.
No, and
they
don't
never have a ski area if this keeps up.
And we can barely pronounce, let alone spell, chalet. But no, the fact of the matter is, we've experienced it here in my own home. It has touched us personally. I've seen my own children hauled into surgery to have things removed that should not be removed at 13 years of age. We felt the windows rattle.
Yep.
From blasts that were taking place on top of you, and we feel them here.
Yeah. Yeah. When this foundation guy calls me, he says, "So mountaintop removal is still going on." I says, "Call me at 4:30, and I'll stick the phone out the window."
Yeah. Well, and again, there's that individual who wrote that thing back in March of 2012 that mountaintop removal has slowed to a trickle.
Yeah. They live near a ski area, I'm sure.
She lives in the Eastern Panhandle near D.C.
Oh, yeah, that's part of West Virginia. I guess it's pretty cool over there. I guess it has slowed to a trickle in Harpers Ferry.
Right, yeah. I don't think it was ever a drop in the first place in Berkeley.
No, yet. I'm kidding. No, you know what? And I blame the big greens for putting those victory dances, you know, on their website. I blame them. And then they felt like they could move on because they'd convinced their members that they had done the Lord's work and now that they were needed elsewhere. But, you know, they never told us. They rolled up their tents in the middle of the night after promising to fight to victory, promising to fight to victory. I'll be like Senator Byrd, promising to fight to victory. And then they had this one meeting that none of us were invited to, and they rolled up their tents, and they left West Virginia, and they never returned. And then they claimed victory. Now, it's okay to run. It's okay to run. It's not honorable to run, but it's okay. But to claim victory after running, that's not honorable. But even that would be okay. But it hurt us. Because now when I try to raise money, I go, oh, we're on to something else. Our foundation doesn't do that anymore. And why? Because people like Mike Bruin told him it wasn't necessary. You know, this thing is being mopped up. Well, who's doing the mopping up, huh? I don't see anybody mopping up around here. It's back to the same few people that we had 10 years ago. You know?
Yeah.
And we've lost some of our best ones. And we've gotten some new ones. You know, we're still strong. You know, we're not going anywhere, but we're doing it by ourselves. You know, we do have some key allies around the country. But, you know, the big greens are, for the most part, absent. And I think that is shameful, shameful, shameful.
Well, and the only way to cure the error of their ways is
to support the AIC Act and to actually get in the halls, to spend some money, to go shake down some Congress people, to raise some money and send it to AIC campaigns so we can send our Appalachians to D.C. so they can buy a beer after working all day for free. That's all we ask. We have a little apartment. We put them on the floor and a mat. We work the piss out of them, and we can't even get money for that. They've got money coming out of their ears to fight coal-fired power plants.
$50 million.
They won't shake nothing down here for us. And yet they use us. You know, they'll take somebody from Appalachia to one of their big, fancy, you know, $200 plate dinners, and they'll give them a little award, maybe send them home with a $1,000 check, and then they'll raise $10 million. And we won't see a nickel of it.
No, it's what we call the dancing hillbilly syndrome.
That's exactly right. And we're sick of it.
Yeah, real sick of it. Well, Mike, I thank you very kindly. Yeah, we could, but I thank you very much for all the time that you spent.
All right. I love working with you, Bob, and I can't wait till the next time we get together. Maybe we could even have a bourbon or something.
I tell you what, that'd tickle me pink.
All right, but
you take care, brother Mike. Bye now.
All right, bye.
Mike Rozelle, legendary campaigner, leader of Climate Ground Zero. And yeah, my friend, your thoughts are more than welcome on everything that we've been talking about. I've been getting emails along the way. I've shared a few of them. You know the number, 304-658-3333. Jump right in. Or on the Skype line, Bob Kincaid Horn is the contact there. Either way works just fine. And we'll take a little break and come back. This is Conversation Radio. We are down to $180. Thanks very much to Jeremy. We're down to $180 toward matching Randy's kind contribution from the 1st of December. And any help is great help. It's how we keep all of this going, plain and simple. Conversation Radio, you know? Yeah. I'm Bob Kincaid. Light up the phones. We'll be back.
around. Tonight there's gonna be trouble. Some of us won't survive. See the boys in mean business busting out dead or alive. I can hear the hound dogs on my trail. All hell breaks loose, alarm and sirens wail. Like the game, if you lose, go to jail. Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak.
Yeah, that seemed appropriate. Jailbreak from Thin Lizzy. It's about 17 minutes before the hour, and thank you very much to our buddy Ed, who just took us down to $130 to match what Randy started December off with. Thanks very, very much. A couple of notes, and then to the phones. You know the number, 304-658-3333. Since we were talking about mountaintop removal, and, well, I had a note earlier from Dr. John. Subject line, today in bioanthropology. Today was the last lecture where I covered challenges we'll face in coming generations that have both cultural and biological components. I talk about climate change, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and industrial pollution. Mountaintop removal is, of course, a big topic. We spent about 10 minutes playing with the What's My Connection to Mountaintop Removal widget at ilovemountains.org. The students were deeply impressed by that, and I noticed more than a dozen wrote down the website. And in both sections, there were lots of questions. One woman even said, after I showed a map of surface mine sites and poverty rates by county in central Appalachia, this isn't really about the environment. It's about justice. Dr. John says, I could have swooned. I wonder if she's a listener. And then Dr. John closes saying, all of this, of course, I owe to this program. And that moves me deeply. It gave me chills when I read that, and the second time around as well. Realities like this cannot be, I don't think, can be adequately defined by the for-profit media. I just don't. But thank you, Dr. John, creating some space for reality to happen inside your classroom. This isn't really about the environment. It's about justice. And that is the absolute, absolute truth. Because when it's a matter of living and dying, issues like human health and human rights become much more relevant. And something as nebulous as so-called environmentalism seems almost an aesthetic afterthought. And I think you know what I mean by that. Dr. John also noted, what a splendid interview with an amazing activist. This is what sets the Horn apart, bringing dedicated people together over vital issues. This is thanks to you and to Mike Rozelle. Well, thank you, Dr. John, and to everyone else who heard Mike's words. Thank you. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
You had to come to me first.
Hey, Bill, what's happening?
You just told me the last hour and a half. I just learned what's happening. If I wasn't suspicious, if I thought I was being a little paranoiaically suspicious after hearing you two guys, I know I wasn't when it came to some of these social units, you know. Because I had funny feelings during the anti-Vietnam War era about how many people were down there to meet other people, or who was down there really raising hell about the war going on. And me, I raised hell for a different reason, because I thought it was totally unjustifiable, and secondly, and maybe most importantly, because it was killing friends of mine, totally unwinnable. But listening to you guys is like, Jesus, H, the fighting that has to go on with his situation when he was, you know, on the hunger strike. And man, I thought I had guts when I was young, but maybe I didn't. It's unbelievable at times. Because I saw a lot of crap go on up here during the 60s, but it doesn't begin to measure up to that kind of stuff. I mean, it's for such a real, tangible, you can reach out and put your finger on it and touch, like what he had in the bottle, you know, the fallout. Jesus.
Yeah, the dust.
Yep. We had a situation here around the old Willow Freeway, which was Route 21, didn't come all the way into downtown. Now it's, 77, Interstate 77. These people that lived down there, the old ladies would hang their clothes out to dry. And when they went to get them, they were mysteriously covered with fine red dust from the steel mills. So this stuff is not new, and you could take us back farther with the coal situation, you know, and what it has done for how many generations?
Oh, well, mountaintop removal itself has been going on. The first operation opened in 1972, but it was done on a very limited basis up until the late 1990s, and with the arrival of George W. Bush on the scene, it went absolutely hog wild, Bill.
See, I didn't know where it started, you know, so that's...
It started as the crow flies. It started about 10 miles from me.
In other words, is it because they couldn't get the coal out any other way?
No!
Or was it because this way was cheaper for them?
Oh, it's monumentally cheaper.
Uh-huh.
The margins get much less narrow when you're not employing human beings.
Yeah.
You can take down 5,000 acres in 5 years with a crew of about 15 demolition workers.
So in other words, there isn't even the living wage that was being paid for men to risk their life, which didn't measure up either, but to a head of a household, you risk your life on a daily basis, but there was more money than they can make doing anything else.
Well, you can drop out of high school at 16, 17 now.
Yeah.
And you can then go and get yourself a job, if there are any jobs to be had, running a D9 cat on a mountaintop removal plot, and start out making $45,000, $50,000 a year, and after 10 or 15 years on the job, you can be pulling down six figures.
Yeah, but how many men making the six figure compared with how many hundreds of men were risking their lives daily for
there's 100,000 dead from black lung alone.
Yeah.
Over the last 100 years, then we start adding up the numbers from the mine explosions, the underground mine explosions and whatnot, and it gets even higher. But in terms of people actually employed, Bill, consider that around 1980 there were 100,000 coal miners in the state of West Virginia alone.
Yeah.
As of this conversation we're having right now, there are less than 15,000. Of those, 4,000 or thereabouts are mountaintop removal workers. And yet they are...
It was terrible enough as a job, but at least there was a job.
But wait, Bill, it gets better or worse, depending on your perspective. Of those people who are doing mountaintop removal now, they are producing more coal in this state this year than has ever been produced in any other year in this state's history, and they're doing it with a tenth of the workforce.
Oh, exactly what the new capitalism really wants.
Yeah.
Fewer workers, because now they can get away with it.
Right, and the United Mine Workers of America, which was once upon a time a profound and driving force...
doesn't exist.
Well, it exists, but it is a shadow of its former self.
Well, I remember when was it when all hell was breaking loose in the UMW of A? Yablonsky?
Yeah.
What year was that? Was that 70s?
Yeah, that's the 1970s.
Yeah, because I know the Wall Street Journal was running a big story on it when I was at a flunky job down there, me and your buddy Dennis working down there.
1969, actually. Jock Yablonsky was murdered on December the 31st, 1969.
Boy, and they really went after the unions hard. They were going after them hard in those days. I mean, Hoffa was not exactly a Boy Scout, you know? But I never met a Teamster who wasn't, a retired Teamster who was not real happy with Mr. Hoffa and their retirement benefits. Not that he was maybe the nicest guy in the world, but... the workers themselves, you know, except the difference between the Teamsters and the coal miners, that's been a horrible job since it was first done. You know, the coal miners made a name for themselves in the Civil War. They dug that mine at Petersburg. That was the...
It's known as the crater now.
Yeah. And, hell, it got so bad in World War I that I had a book years ago, War Underground, and these guys were... if they couldn't get across the trenches, they were going to try to go under, and they would actually break into each other underground in hand-to-hand combat, how many feet below the earth, you know? Unbelievable how human beings will always seem to find a good way to screw each other up, you know? But man, I mean, I got to give, this guy has more courage than any, and I've seen some pretty tough guys in my life, but... that kind of courage, I mean, I was in the SWAM once, and a friend of mine had to bail money there for a minor deal, and within 2 hours, another friend of mine got the judge to come in and hold a hearing and get me the hell out of there. It was a Friday, and I had to work that night. What nerve, what guts.
Well, you mentioned early coal mining. It should never be forgotten, Bill, that some of the earliest coal miners in the United States were slaves.
Yes.
And it was a death sentence.
I didn't know that until you started talking about it. Of course, it made perfect sense. I mean, based on the logic of perfect insanity, you know, that one man can own another. I'm surprised they didn't use it in your state as a...
It was the original operating model of the coal industry in the post-Civil War years.
You take a human being, you tell them where tell the human being where the family can live. You threaten them to make sure that as long as that they must obey every command, or else they'll be thrown out. You know, you couldn't just outright kill them anymore. And you refuse to pay them in American money.
Well, you old Tennessee Ernie wasn't far off with that big selling song he did, was he?
No.
And that, is that amazing that that song sold so much?
Oh, no. I think it spoke to some deep-seated resentments, and of course it also hit the charts after the ascendancy of the United Mine Workers.
Yeah.
So it could be taken as a sort of an anthem to labor.
Yeah.
And understood as a reflection of things to which they did not wish to go back, because to owe one soul to the company store. That was a generation prior. That was my grandfather. You know, there's a photograph that hangs on the little biscuit joint wall downtown here, and it's 1922, and my grandfather is 28 years old.
Oh my!
His first two children have been born, and he's standing there in front of the mouth of the mine at the Gauley Mountain Coal Company. And I look at that photograph and I think, Granddad, my God, what you had coming at you. And at that point in time, he had 46 more years of life in him.
Jesus. I mean, just going to that job took more courage than I had. I'd done anything, I think, but, you know, I don't think I could have ever done it.
And see, I see the people who stand up against these toxic thieves of human health, people like Roselle. I see them as the heirs to the tradition that people like my grandfather and many other grandfathers and great-grandfathers in this state and in Central Appalachia. I see people like Roselle and Bo Webb as heirs to that tradition of refusal to simply have life cheapened, demeaned, and stolen from them. It's, you know, the heirs of the original organizers of the UMWA aren't sitting in the UMWA headquarters in Washington, or, you know, in across the river in Virginia.
Yeah.
They're living on the ground in the sacrifice zone, howling and beseeching and working day in and day out to end the torment, just as their grandfathers and great-grandfathers did, and great-grandmothers. And grandmothers, because it took families to stand together against the predatory conduct of the coal industry.
Well, on my dad's side, my great grandfather was a priest in the Roman Catholic Church at the time, and he married the housekeeper and quit the church. But and then they went back to Austria because, you know, I guess there was, he was in PA. So I imagine there were quite a few people of Middle European descent working at that time for him to end up coming from the old country to become a pastor of a church. And he decided that marrying the housekeeper looked a lot better than the other. And then my granddad, he went back to Vienna with him, and then he came back at age 12, and he did a little mining in PA, and then he came up to Cleveland and worked for the New York Central. He told my father he just couldn't work it. He was only about 5'4" and thin. As I told you, his job was to climb into the goddamn steam engines and clean the coal residue out of the stacks. Wonder why he died at 53, huh?
I don't.
Because it seemed to be there were so many jobs that were almost everything you did, but we've forgotten. I mean, the generation, the young folks have totally forgotten what working in different situations was like. Working, hell, running a punch press. There used to be an old thing where you held up your first finger and your little finger, and it was a punch press operator ordering four beers, because it was so common to lose fingers in those things. I think we've lost touch with the just plain guts these guys had to go to work every day. And the women had the same situation, to have to try to raise a family on the money, and, you know, that's why, I guess that's why Prohibition got a punch from somewhere, and believe it or not, it was Oberlin College, which we would not think about as being a that kind of place, but they got, they helped push the ball on Prohibition, because it was just, what can guys do, Bob, besides after a day's work like that? And alcohol being available, and it was, in other words, it was an occupational hazard, was it not? To do any kind of miserable, physical, dirty, dangerous work and not drink a little bit? To break the spell?
How do you not?
Yeah, how did you not do it is right. But anyway, I won't keep you, but it hit me between the eyes. I, you know, I've kind of forgotten what I used to know about it, and I just learned an awful lot. Now, this, because I took part in anti-war stuff, and it was nothing compared to what he went through. Well, what's his name again?
Oh, Mike Rozelle.
Yeah. That's, he's got him. He's got a big set, and a lot of females had him too when it came to that stuff. I'll tell you, going into, you know, the arrests and the crap, because what he was describing in his time, you know, with no blankets, and what the hell would he, is this the gulag or what? You know, we tend to forget what can be done by people in authority. But let me clear the, I wanted to ask you a question before I go. This is, I was going to, I was headed for Antietam, and I stayed in West Virginia the first night, and then we took an interstate across, it seemed to come out of West Virginia and went slightly north toward Washington, PA, and at one point you went across this bridge, and down below were boats and water, it seemed like a mile below you, on the interstate. Do you know where that was?
I'm thinking you were coming across what is now known as I-68.
Okay.
And then you probably jumped on 79 and came up and hooked into 70 and went on westward.
Yeah, 70 was how you got off at somewhere around Hagerstown and then headed south to... in fact, I think we had a room in Hagerstown and spent the next day or day and a half in Sharpsburg, you know.
Yeah.
And then headed... Because I'm still trying to, and there's another road that I can never remember. You go past an advertisement for the where the Potomac, where they went through the mountain to take the C&O Canal.
Yeah. That's I was just there in August. Cumberland.
Yeah.
Cumberland, Maryland.
That was around there was the. The health spa, you know, that had the fence around it so high you could take a semi behind it and nobody would see the truck back there. You couldn't identify it, you know. Human nature never fails to amaze me. But I've had some great help from a couple of members of the family who helped me pack some stuff and have been really good. And what a bunch of guys, you know, and folks in the I'm so proud to be associated with this, because I haven't seen some of this type of man and woman since I was a kid, and the war was in full gear. I got away from the whole thing and became a semi-middle class kind of a guy with a nice place to live and a good, well, if music was ever a good job, it was, and during my time at, you know, on the top of the game here in Cleveland, and no complaints, except, well, damn it, it just didn't last long enough.
Well, no, the good stuff never does.
Well, I almost croaked at age 51, so what the hell, you know. But it just amazes me to see us going backwards in time, is what it amounts to. Or it never slipped. We thought we had, when we beat Goldwater and shut that war down with constant. When the kids started coming home, when the young guys started coming home, and a lot of them just, they weren't too happy with what they had to do and see. And that, when the guys started coming home raising hell about it in newspaper articles, and that's what finally, well, Nixon had a freaking secret plan that he wouldn't even tell himself. Lying sack of shit. Anyway, take care of yourself.
Don't hold back, Bill.
Well, I never do.
Well, so I got to ask you, because people will ask me, is the move all done, or?
Oh, no. We're just getting moving. I have to go to the place tomorrow and finish the paper signing. But it should be good. That's a neighborhood, that Covington Road area. I had a house on the other side of the street, just up the hill. My first wife and I owned a nice four-bedroom. Well, we bought a land contract from her dad. You know how those things work.
Oh, God.
And well, it was a good deal. Nice house, a nice area. But it'll be good to be back there again, because I spent so much time there. It was they had a 3-day festival up there every year and played that so many times I can't count them. And it was just a great place to go and shake hands with a lot of guys you didn't see regularly, other musicians, and all of us lying to each other about how good we were. You know, I mean, is that human nature? What can I tell you? Anyway, my personal thanks go out to a couple of guys, and right now I'm trying to learn about something I used to know about, and that was, hell, I had a cell phone that came in a bag when I had one.
The bag phone. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've got to get something else now, because you can't count on the Bell system to have your stuff hooked up, you know, or when you move into a place. This company is, I mean, I can't tell you how bad. I went through this crap with that one special thing they have, and it wouldn't work in this building. I'd be talking to somebody, and then they were gone. And they'd call me back and say, Bill, what did I say that you hung up on me? I said, well, nothing this time. Anyway, pick up the phone. There's plenty of guys I want to talk to, my young buddy out in Colorado, because they just got nailed with more snow than they needed. And there's like three or four of the guys in the family that I have become quite close to. You know, the one guy had been down a little south of me, and another guy a little farther south, and one guy who lives in the county I used to live in. So, and a fine bunch of folks. And well, I live in a building full of very nice people, but their knowledge of what's going on around them isn't as strong as it should be. And that's why I've been kind of isolated over here for years now and kept to myself, and that's what made me not friendly with management about a lot of things. Because I would actually gripe about stuff that shouldn't have been happening, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, you take care.
All right, you have a good night, Bill. We'll talk soon.
Good night.
Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy, what's happening?
Well, Mike's story was quite impressive and quite compelling to me, having worked in the prison system for a while. Not now, but in the past, I can completely see where he was put, and I don't think any of those three, with the exception of the drunk tank is commonly used for intake people until their paperwork's finalized and they're given a place in the jail. Now, the two next cells, the suicide cell is the most severe, but the whole cell, that's usually used for bad behavior. So unless he was throwing things and really saying nasty things to the guard and threatening them with physical violence, I don't see any reason why he was put there. Now, the suicide cell, that was used just, I only laugh because I know why they used it, and it's pretty sick. But they used it to break his will. Essentially, that's what they were doing.
Yeah, trying to get him to beg. Yeah.
Basically get him to beg and stay off the path he was on, which was basically, well, screw you, I'm right, and I'm going to get you back for this, but do it in a nice way. I mean, if anything, he handled this the way Jesus would have taught him to handle it, honestly. It sounded like he was nothing but polite to them, told them whether they were wrong, but went along with what they said and basically said, you're wrong, and in the end, I'll prevail. And he did. I mean, like he said.
I hope he can sue him into bankruptcy, but, you know.
Yeah, not in the prison industrial system. He'll never sue them into bankruptcy. There'll always be, unfortunately, Well, maybe we can get around it someday. But there are always going to be corrupt judges, and it sounds like there's quite a few of them in West Virginia. We have a couple here in Vermont who are questionable in terms of what they've done. Speaking of jail, did you see the story that came across the Newswire today that, actually two interesting stories. I'll give you the positive one first, then we'll go back to the jail, but I guess off the coast of Hawaii, they just found a World War II era Japanese sub, a massive one they didn't know was there.
No.
Yeah, it just came across the Newswire. They just found, I guess, a really big sub that could have sailed around the Earth, they said, twice without refueling.
I'll be damned. What kind of, did they say anything about the condition of it?
No, it was just came across the Discovery feed that I have linked to Facebook, and while you were talking to Bill there for a second, I saw it pop up.
Yeah, that's I'll have to go and have a. I love that kind of story. I love those stories.
I love that kind of history too. Even if it's a bad time, I still do. Makes me feel bad for the families because I'm sure there must have been a ship that never came back. I mean, obviously. Well, duh. But my other story was, I heard another story today that a guy was released from jail after serving 25 years for murdering his wife that he never killed.
Yeah, I saw that in Texas.
Yeah. Now, was there any? They didn't show it. I didn't see any pictures of it. Was there any indication of just the curiosity skin color?
No, white guy.
He was okay. From the sound of the story, they didn't mention any race, so I figured he might be a white guy. And you hear about this occasion. I mean, what is it? I can't think right now. But that famous movie about the one-armed bandit, and they made two movies out of it, basically. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But what struck me about that story was that his son, who I think was like 6 or 7 at the time, now he's my age, told the investigators, the police, and people that my dad was at work. It wasn't my dad. But they just threw out what the kid said, and even what he said when he said, no, I was at work, it couldn't have been me. And then withheld evidence about stuff they found in the woods.
Yeah, and the prosecutor who withheld the evidence did 5 days in jail of a 10-day jail sentence for withholding evidence, entered a no-contest plea, and was disbarred and stripped of his judgeship.
Wait, Bob, no, you know what made up for it, though? He had to pay a $500 fine. So that made everything okay. I mean, it's fine.
Absolutely.
The other guy did 25 years. What's a slap on the wrist for doing the wrong thing? I mean, really. And Chancellor, it wasn't on his permanent record either.
And now he's going to spend the rest of his life working on some innocence project, which is admirable. But what Roselle was talking about, and it's the strange way that those doors open. You go into something concerned about issue one, and you come out deeply concerned about issue two.
I'm concerned. The prison system, from the view I saw, which was for about a year, was enough for me working there myself. But it definitely targets you based on your income. If you have not so much income, but the wealth around you. If you have more money, you definitely have a better, I guess, whatever you would call level of life in there based on, like, commissary and stuff like that. You can buy stuff like, ramen noodles. And having small things like that do make a difference when you're confined to those cement walls for whatever reason you're there. But also, like you said, when you call someone outside the prison and you don't work there, it's a quick call to your family members. And what you're calling is essentially, without dialing it, it bills like a 900 number to your family.
Yeah, you get billed like it's a sex line.
Yeah, I think families pay up to like to $150 a minute per minute, or maybe it's some maximum level of like $5 for the first 10 minutes and then $1.50 after that. So I mean, you essentially have to have a lot of money to even make phone calls to your family, or someone really generous to pay that kind of money. So they make it almost.
Well, but it's not surprising because. It is the prison industrial complex now, Jeremy.
Right.
It's there to make money. It is not there to administer punishment to people who cross the justice system. It is not there to rehabilitate people who, for any variety of reasons, have fallen afoul of the criminal code. It is there to make money off of poor people.
Right. I would say there's a pretty strong evidence that from day one, prisons, jails, whatever, have always been aimed at the poor because they're less likely to fight their way out of it because they don't have the money to defend themselves, especially based on our economic system in this country. I mean, capitalism is a perfect device for jails. It really is.
Absolutely. It's well, they're sort of made for one another, aren't they? I mean, remember, did Great Britain actually give us the debtor's prison, you know, where you go to jail simply because you're poor?
Yeah, this was a couple of years back. Maybe sooner than that, but I think it was within the last couple of years. I happened to flick over to Randy for a few minutes, ago, and she had mentioned that slowly, it's scary, but slowly things like debtor's prisons are based on going to jail based on a debt are slowly coming back.
Oh, I don't think there's anything slowly about it. I mean, if you depending on what state you're looking at, it's there in full force. You can go to jail in a place like Alabama for having an unpaid civil judgment. You know, let's say some debt collector sues you. You don't pay the debt collector, you go to jail.
See, I guess I'm fortunate to live in the North because in my state, it's an unsecured debt, so all they can do is really harass you. They can bring you to court, and at court they'll try to give you the old threat of you'll pay lawyer's fees. Guess what the lawyer's fees are? It's $25 to file a case. That's what you pay extra. You're not paying the lawyers. They do that. So you don't think get that tacked on. But they'll threaten you up the yin-yang to try to scare you. In the end, you go to court and tell them what you can pay. And guess what? The judge is going to say, fine by me, and you pay that. They can't do anything else to you here. But I guess that's fortunate living here.
But no, it can be far, far worse. Mississippi stand, Alabama, Georgia stand. They're brutal places.
And I have a feeling that's what she was... I think she had mentioned the southern states in particular. And I think the state she was talking about was Alabama, in fact.
Probably. I mean, hell, they'll yank your driver's license in Alabama over an unpaid civil debt.
Wow. That's pretty severe.
And then you get... And nine times out of ten, you don't know about it. And when you get pulled over, you didn't know you were running around on a suspended license. So, boom, off to the clink, and you got two charges.
That's nice. I'm sure Alabama has traffic cams somewhere, too, so they can give you a ticket from a remote location saying you ran a red light or...
Yeah, but you know what? Things in Alabama, they got bigger things to worry about in Alabama. That tremendous football game that took place on Saturday with the amazing ending where Auburn... You know, ran back a missed field goal for 108 yards to win the game in the final second. Was pretty amazing. I was rooting for Alabama. It was the damnedest football game I've ever seen. Enjoyed every second of it. But lo and behold, it was the next day when the story broke, if it was even 24 hours, Jeremy, that a woman at an Alabama-Auburn football game watching party had gunned down another human being because she didn't feel that they were sufficiently upset about Alabama losing. And by gunned down, I mean dead.
Was this a case of her saying she was standing her ground?
No. No, apparently not. Just blazed away.
Wow. But I'll clear the lines because I'll tell you one more quick thing. You mentioned how about your grandfather. Well, I don't know if you know of a country singer out there. He's a little known guy. He's Jamie Johnson.
No.
He's famous because he wrote most of Alabama's music.
Okay.
You know, he's an independent artist. But he does a song called In Color. That is my grandfather's life to a T. And even though my grandfather's gone, whenever I hear that song, I think about him more than anyone can imagine. Because that was totally his life.
Well, I'll have to go and check that out.
It's a good song, but yeah, Jamie Johnson has fame for having written most of Alabama's music.
I didn't recognize the name, but I'm well familiar with the product of the boys from Fort Payne.
Yeah, definitely. That's what it is. But with that, I'll let someone else talk because I've been here long enough.
All right, you have a good evening, Jeremy. Take care.
You too. Thank you very much.
Bye now. From Vermont, that's our buddy Jeremy. Lines open, 304-658-3333. Hey, welcome to the program.
And how are you tonight?
Oh, I'm pretty good, Jim. How about you?
Oh, pretty good, I guess. You know, all things being considered. First, you know, it's strange about the debtor's prisons. I think Georgia, under Oglethorpe, was established as a colony for people who were imprisoned for indebtedness.
Wasn't the same true of, at least in part, the Botany Bay colony in Australia?
Yeah, I think so. But I remember Oglethorpe and, you know, his efforts to give people a second chance and to free them from the debt. Of course, it wasn't done out of total, you know, humanity. I mean, it was a way to free the prisons and also to, you know, to establish a colony, which would benefit the mother country. You know, it's always a two-way street, right?
Sure.
And going back to, let's see, Mr. Roselle's comments and what he went through in, I guess it was Charleston, right?
I guess it was the South Central Regional Jail outside of Charleston.
Yeah, I guess so, but nonetheless, you know, that's sort of redolent of some type of modified, intense, you know, enhanced interrogation or a way to basically break a person down. Number one, deprivation of food, sensory deprivation, environmental change, that type of thing. And unless you're a very strong person, you really can't resist that type of encroachment upon your humanity. And there is no, as far as I know, Geneva Convention that could govern the conduct of people who have been incarcerated. It's a pretty bad thing. And I can remember when, you know, being incarcerated was, their philosophy was to rehabilitate and, you know, make the person more accessible.
Yeah, that's gone.
For reentry into society. But now it's more punitive rather than palliative. And it is a big money-making thing. It is. And which reminds me of things that happened, for example, when people were interned and imprisoned in Europe during the Second World War. It was all determined on the cost of the maintenance of how many Reichsmarks it took to maintain a prisoner for 3 months, which was basically their, you know, average lifetime expectation, and to which they could produce for companies like IG Farben and wherever, who had, you know, subcants and things like that, that were designed to make money for the big industrial barons. And unfortunately, it would appear to me that type of approach to imprisonment and lack of humanity and lack of decency has sort of reared its ugly head once again.
Oh, I think it has. And perhaps with more virulence than it has ever had before.
It would appear so, because, I mean, they basically calculate how much it costs to maintain a prisoner for a year. I'm not sure what those figures are. I used to know them, but I've forgotten them. And then as opposed to the profit edge of doing that. But I do know that in California, they have begun, because of overcrowding and stuff like that, they've begun to release a lot of people who are nonviolent and, you know, drug crimes and stuff like that, because it simply isn't working. I mean, it may make a few contractors wealthy or make a few people economically better off. But nonetheless, I think they've begun to realize that, you know, this whole type of penal philosophy doesn't work. But in this country, I mean, we talk about prisons throughout the world. I mean, I remember back in 1981, we were fifth as far as the biggest lockup nation in the world was concerned, with the Soviet Union being the first with their gulags. And I think pretty much we've come up a couple notches, haven't we?
You'd like to hope, but do you wonder?
I think we have become like the number one and number two biggest lockup.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood you. No, we lock up a higher percentage of our citizens than any other so-called industrialized nation.
Well, when you compare that to the Soviet gulags and the stuff that was...
Hell, I don't think the Soviet gulags during their heyday could touch what we got now.
Well, I mean, you know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn in Gulag Archipelago back in the 70s or whenever, he published that because he was a prisoner himself. And, you know, he described the conditions of the prisons there. And when you look at places like, what's that big one in Louisiana?
Angola.
My God. I mean, I don't think the Soviets could hold a candle to that. I mean, of course, I guess they could. In Angola, it's swamps and alligators and stuff like that, because any man who probably tries to leave there is going to be either devoured or apprehended or shot under dubious conditions. And, well, you look at Karaganda, which was one of the, or Vorkuta, some of the Soviet prisons under Stalin, are pretty bad too. It's basically, as far as I'm concerned, from what Mr. Roselle was saying, the treatment that he underwent was another example of man's inhumanity to man. And there's no excuse for that.
Oh, no.
There's just no excuse for that. I mean, I worked in a prison for a year, and I can remember hearing the sound to the wailing of prisoners that were confined to what they call the hole, solitary confinement, total sensory deprivation, complete isolation from any type of thing, deprivation of food, water, that type thing, maybe bread and water if they were lucky. And to hear that wail from a human being is something I've never forgotten. I mean, you could hear it through...
concrete, probably.
Exactly. Exactly, you could. And it's really, really terrible. And I wouldn't have the courage of this man to undergo what, you know, I sent you an email. Basically, what he went through was some type of modified, enhanced interrogation on the oblique. It was basically a passive way of attempting to break the person down and to create situations in which he would give way to the, you know, to the will of the people who were imprisoning him. But I mean, you know, it's a very impressive conversation. I appreciate your sharing it with us. And you know,
Mike is an amazing human being.
Well, I wish.
I mean, he's very much a joyful campaigner.
Well, that's quite a lot to say about him, considering that he's been.
He's not kidding when he says that he trained most of the people who are leading most of the big greens now.
Well, you know, that's the thing. You've got your cause with the AIC Act and things like that in Appalachia. They're sandwiched between, number one, the people who don't want it to stop, and the people who are supposed to support these people. And you're really in a big valley there, because you don't have the support of the Sierra Club and other big greens, as he said. And then, of course, you've got I'll call that passive non-support. And then you have active support of the people on the right who want that to continue. And you guys are in a really big valley there. You really are.
It feels that way sometimes, Jim.
Of course it is that way. And look at the Congress of the United States. I mean, good Lord in heaven. They can't even govern the country. They can't even pass the budget. And like I say, a lot of these guys up there, you know, basically pay lip service to this, that, and the other. and the only thing they're interested in is being reelected and maintaining their own lifestyle and positions of power and pomp and circumstance. And that's pretty bad for an elected representative or a senator. But that's just the way it is, because basically it's governed by, I guess, what they call in Egypt, bakshish, or, you know, lots of money.
Yeah.
Whoever has the money.
Or as they say in the mob, the vig.
Well, the vig, whatever you want to call it. I mean, you know, ill-gotten gains has so many names. And I'm not laughing because I think it's funny. I'm just laughing because of the irony of it. But nonetheless, it's just incredible. I mean, if you don't have the money and if you don't have the way to grease somebody's palm or whatever, it would just appear to me that you are basically in a not the best of tactical situations, nor are you in the best of strategic situations. You're not. I mean, that's just the way government works and the way the government today works. I mean, government used to be 20, 30 years ago, maybe before the advent of certain politicians, whom we don't need to name them, and leadership. Government used to be a method of helping people and installing palliative rather than punitive measures on individuals. But now it appears to me with the influence of government plus these huge corporations who have, you know, bought them and they hold them in their hands, like Don Corleone held so many judges and politicians in his pocket. It's not a very good report card, that's for damn sure.
No, and there's an eternal struggle. Well, I don't know how much of a struggle is, but there's an eternal question of how do we break that stranglehold of money on politics?
Mm. That, my friend, is a $64,000 question, because no matter how high-minded and Mr. Smith goes to Washington type of situation concerns, once they get there, they become members of the club and they say, oh, this is how it works. And, you know, you have the K Street people and the Wall Street people basically having them in their pockets and not the people who originally sent them there. And, of course, every once, every 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, whatever, 2 and 6, as far as Congress is concerned, I think you have a lot of people who simply are beguiled to the point where they are really just representing themselves and the interests of the people who pay them so much money. I mean, these political elections that we have every 2, 4, and 6 years, my God, I don't know of any country in the world that spends as much money on the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the White House as far as campaigns, this, that, and the other. And it basically comes down to a contest of who can spend the most money, influence the candidate the most, because it's such a, I mean, I think this election process is what I'm trying to drive at, has become one of the biggest money makers of all time, really.
It's a money machine, isn't it?
Well, it's hard to break the money machine. I mean, once the money machine is in Scott said, they're in control, as long as the money flows and the bakshish is the big thing as far as, you know, being able to bribe or to influence and have access to people who are in the corridors of power. I mean, it's gotten to the point that I don't know what could break it. I wish I had the answer. I don't. I've seen it happen. I lived in D.C., understood how it worked and stuff like that. And, you know, a lot of times no matter what you do, if you want to pad the halls of Congress and try to influence these legislators and that and the other, they may receive you saying, okay, sure, no problem, we understand, but we'll get back to you later. But then, in the backs of their minds, they're not going to do anything to help anybody, only unless it helps them stay in office.
Yeah, well, vested interests.
Of
course. Now, like I've said, you know, for a whole lot of members of the House who are from the Pacific Coast, signing onto the AIC Act has been a no-brainer. It was like, yeah, really? Oh, cool, I'm there.
Uh-huh.
Because they have constituencies that value that in their legislators. Others have been harder sells.
Well, that's the difference between California and the West Coast, and as you travel eastward, and you have so many things that are going to stand in your way. But that's just, you know, the legislative process is not exactly a very easy one to follow.
But that's not to say that nobody but the West Coast has been involved with this. For instance, in this Congress, one of the original co-sponsors, along with John Yarmuth of Kentucky, is Louise Slaughter of upstate New York, and she is an amazing progressive force. Paul Tonko of New York is on the bill. Gwen Scott from Milwaukee is on the bill.
Right. Well, I'm sure Milwaukee has its own place.
Steve Cohen from Memphis is on the bill.
How many others numerically are supporting your bill?
45 right now.
45, that's one-tenth of the House of Representatives, right?
Yeah.
Well, you definitely have your work cut out for you, but, you know, without staff and resources and things of that nature, it's going to be very difficult. And, of course, you've got to have somebody who's going to support you, who has enough money, enough lobbyists and people like that to say, well, you know, this is not a good thing and we need to correct it.
Well, you know, I don't think we necessarily need the lobbyists, Jim, because what Mike Rozelle said about Bo Webb's talents are very much the truth. He's one of the most effective people you'll ever want to see work the halls of Congress, and frankly, I'm not bad either. But the means to support that work is badly needed. And of course, it can't happen without people working their own congresspeople in their own districts saying, listen, you know, you don't sign on, I don't vote for you.
Well, you're not going to find a lot of people throughout the entire country who are going to really, and I would be perfectly frank with you, who care that much about Appalachia.
Well, you'd be surprised. One organization sent out a blast email, Jim, and it got 34,000 responses to individual members of Congress.
Well, responses may be one thing, but action from those responses, that's simply another. I mean, are these 34 responses out of a voting population of this country? I mean, you've got to, you know, do the numbers here.
Yeah, but when you consider the number of people who don't even bother to get off the couch, let alone contact a member of Congress, it becomes rather impressive.
Yeah, it does. I mean, really, because there are a lot of people right now throughout this country who are worried about so many other things. I mean, these are not good times, in spite of what thou average or the VASTAC or whatever financial indices are concerned. But
yeah, that's the Dow and NASDAQ and Amex and S&P have absolutely no relevance to the day-to-day doings of struggling America.
Well, I think they certainly do. They do, and as far as influence are concerned, they do. I mean, they're economic indices that basically influence the way people feel.
No, but what I mean by that, Jim, is that where once upon a time the Dow Jones Industrial Average number was a good indicator of the overall prosperity of the country, it isn't anymore. I mean, the Dow is going up and up and up and up and up, and yet unemployment remains at 7.2%.
Yeah, well, at least that's better than 8%. But nonetheless, the Dow is at, what, 16? Was it back in the 15,000 range now?
I didn't look today, but
I think it dropped yesterday about, or over the weekend about maybe 200 points or something like that. But, you know, as far as that is concerned, I mean, these are huge indicators throughout the world. It's, you know, whether it's a Dow or whether it's a Nikkei or whether it's a DAX or whatever, you know, about what's going on. And what I'm just trying to say is the psychological impact that it has upon people, and it's just there, and it does. And you have it trumpeted from every news station, from CNN to CNBC to MSNBC through, you know, FBN, Fox Business News. That's a real good one right there with Imus and his crowd, you know, and Mr. Barney and some of these other critters on there. Oh, Lord, they're just hard to tolerate. But nonetheless, you know, it's a very shaky world. And people are not feeling very confident in a lot of things, particularly their own governments, particularly with the political situation abroad, and whether or not, you know, if this is going to work or that's going to work with the Middle East or whomever, or whether or not the Ukraine is going to support the people in Kiev. And, you know, it's just, it's everything is in real time, and everybody knows what's going on. Whereas before, we had a little time to sort of recover from cataclysms. And
right, and now it's like having a plate glass window and somebody comes and puts a brick through it once a month. Well, now the bricks are coming every 15 minutes.
There you go. You got it right there, real time. And, you know, and that's their business, is to provide tomorrow's news today, like that James Bond movie character played by whomever, I can't remember his name, but nonetheless... I think his name was Carville or whatever his name was in the movie, but then, you know, that was his business, you know, to provide news and things of that nature. And they're accelerating into that process where they're guessing a lot of stuff and presupposing a lot of things. And we'll just have to wait and see what happens, see if what they predict for tomorrow matches what happened or what actually happened in real time today. But, you know, my respects to your friend, Mr. Rozelle, and what he's gone through. And it sort of reminded me, actually, of Arthur Kersley's The Darkness at Noon. And I don't know if you ever read that book by Arthur Kersley, probably published in 1941, about a man who was placed in a Soviet prison, Rubashov, who was a formerly good Bolshevik who had fallen out of favor, and he ends up in the basement of that particular place, the Lubyanka or wherever it was, with a bullet in the back of his head. I just hope we don't. You need to read that book. It's a wonderful book. Arthur Kersley's A Darkness at Noon, 1941.
I'll look for that.
Yes, you should, because, I mean, it basically differentiates between the humanist Rubashov, who was part of a revolution, and then, of course, the Stalinist Gletkin, who was his interrogator, and eventually his executioner. And it's a very humane look at what happened in those times. And, you know, for people to be placed in jails with superimposed air conditioning, no blankets, a dress, or a smock, or whatever, I don't see how that has any part of any type of penal system. I just don't see that. I mean, you know, good God.
Well, but then again, there. What part is there in the county jail that Joe Arpaio runs in Arizona, where every male inmate is issued a pair of pink panties to wear?
Bob, I couldn't answer that. But I can't imagine why they'd be issued pink panties or whatever.
Well, it's an effort to dehumanize and demasculinize.
I know. Yeah. I understand that. I mean, hell, whatever happened to the old strikes and stuff like that? I mean, what are they going to do? Reestablish chain gangs now? Probably
reestablish. They already exist.
Yeah, I thought that, you know. And that's part of what these people can, you know, basically make a lot of money on, this forced prison labor. I mean, what was that film, the Shawshank Redemption, in which,
yeah,
you know, which was a stellar conviction of our penal system. And this has gone on before. I mean, we talked about this before, and I'm going to get off here because we have other callers. But there's another book by Jessica Mitford called Cheaper Than Chimpanzees.
That I'm familiar with.
And, of course, you know, she was had a sister named Unity Mitford who was in love with Hitler, and Jessica Mitford was a Stalinite or a Stalinist or a leftist. But nonetheless, she wrote a number of books about the prison system in this country and how the pharmaceutical companies were using prisoners for just, greater access to the canteen to get chewing gum, cigarettes, and stuff like that. And then they would be injected with all these drugs like Prolixin and this, that, and the other. It was just horrible, some of the side effects of these drugs. But, I mean, they're using prison populations to use experimental drugs on people. And they have no idea what the contraindications will be. And they don't care either. You know? They don't. Hell, they're doing it enough outside the prison. I mean, have you seen a number of things about Actos and stuff like that, what it's doing to people? It's not good.
No.
I mean, Actos, good Lord. I mean, you know, it's made by a Japanese pharmaceutical company. And now, Actos, which was supposed to be a great drug to control type 2 diabetes, has now become their constant warnings over TV. I mean, they have been since 2010 that it causes increase in bladder cancer and this, that, and the other. And certain European countries will not even market it anymore because of the contraindications and what it does to people's health. Point of fact being is, you know, whether it's pharmaceuticals or whether it's the very fine particles that come from the things that you're going through with your people there, and, you know, it's just not a very healthy world, and it's not a very compassionate world either. And it basically takes a very strong hand, in my opinion, to lead these people in their exodus from this type of situation. And I just hope that one will arise. I do. And speaking of exodus, my thoughts go out to Mr. Stress and his exodus from his primary dwelling to his secondary dwelling. And I certainly hope that he's a lot happier where he is.
I have a feeling there's going to be people there that he'll be a lot happier to be around.
Well, I think so, too. I mean, you know, basically, it could be a blessing in disguise, so to speak, for him. And I hope that it is. I know it's a pain in the ass now. Moving for anybody, whether you're 18 or 81, is not a good thing to do, particularly when you have to do so involuntarily or because of, you know,
man. I've always borne in mind the advice of an old friend of mine who said, if you have to move more than one time in 5 years, it equals a house fire.
Yeah, moving is pretty, I think next to, as far as the hierarchy of trauma is concerned, it's pretty much well up there. It's right up, you know, with a loss of a family member or terminal illness and stuff like that. I mean, I don't know how they grade these things, but I think it's probably number 3 or 4 to write down the thing having to move, particularly when you're having to move against under adverse circumstances. But I'm so glad he's been able to get some help from people, and I wish him all the best. And that's it for me. I hope you have a very good week, and I hope your son does well on his GED.
Yeah, cross your fingers. We got one more bridge to cross.
Well, you know, this is the thing. I thought he was going to finish school and finish with his contemporaries.
Well, I did too.
Well, the GED, I respect, as a former education officer with the Army, I respect that more than somebody who finishes high school, because it proves to me exactly what the person has and doesn't go through, you know, all the stuff in high school, this, that, and the other. However, the military, oh, no. They regard with greater esteem the person who can finish high school as the one who has the GED. And I never quite understood that. Their philosophy is, well, it's the ability of a person to stick through X number of years.
You know what? I think that will change over time, Jim. And I realize changing the military is like changing the church. I mean, that I recognize that.
Well, I hope so. But as far as I'm concerned,
the reason I say that is because with the incidents of brutality and bullying that obtains in our public schools now, and you know, in private schools too, not being able to tolerate it and getting out for one's own, the sake of one's own sanity, health, and well-being. Is something I think you're going to see more and more of.
Well, I hope you're right, but unfortunately, as it stands now, you know, like I say, the military does not regard that in that particular fashion. But nonetheless, GED, I feel, and I've always felt, and I always had problems with people with this, and working with the Army and even with the Air Force and stuff like that, because my position was always, I said, you know, if this guy can pass his test with this, that, and the other, I said, he's just taking a shortcut, and he's just, you know, not wasting so many years of rah-rah life in high school and stuff like that. This, to me, was the proof positive that an individual could perform at a certain level, commensurate with a high school diploma, okay? That was my position. And I was always opposed to that. They said, oh, no. It's part of staying with it. Being able to go through the social whatevers and all the other things that deal with high school and, of course, you know, basically being able to complete a four-year period of academic enlistment, for lack of a better term. That was their position, actually. But I never really bought into that. Because I knew a lot of people who had GEDs who were just a lot better than some of the high school people who just came through there and, you know, oh, yeah, I'm here. I got a high school degree. And they basically were socially promoted because nobody else wanted to deal with them because they were such idiots or behavioral problems. Teachers would simply, you know, say, well, if you want to flunk him, that's fine, but you'll be having me back next year. And that's the way, you know, social promotion,
right,
that and the other.
Yeah.
They don't mean a lot. And on that note, I'm going to close and give you the forum back, and I appreciate what you said, and I wish Mr. Your friend who gave quite a telling description of what he went through, I hope he doesn't have to go through that again.
You know what? But he's not 10 cents worth of afraid if he does.
Well, he's got a lot more balls than I do, because I would not want...
Well, me too.
I mean, I would not want to be put in that situation in which you are basically treated like an animal. I mean,
that's what it boiled down to, yeah.
I mean, basically, I think that basically you have no-kill shelters that get better care than that man did. I mean, particularly with the... I had no idea that was still going on like that, but I guess I've just been so insulated, so isolated in my own little cocoon.
Oh, I've heard old-timers tell me it's worse now than it's ever been.
Well, Bob, that's regrettable. It really is, because basically what we are basically involving ourselves in this country in is another gulag archipelago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good night, buddy.
All right. You take care, Jim.
Out here.
Later. My buddy Jim. And I'm going to move onward here in a moment. One more caller on the line to work into the program before the evening ends. But I wanted to thank Jack. We are now only $110 away from matching Randy's beginning of December challenge, and I want to thank Jack very much for that, and thank you all who have contributed toward that end. Had a note also from Darlene regarding money and politics. She said, isn't it also a question of whether we actually have bona fide public servants and statesmen, stateswomen in Congress? Look at Bernie Sanders. I don't think he's thinking of improving his personal wealth. I feel he's concerned with the welfare of the people of this country. That is first and foremost on his mind. I can't see him being bought out by wealthy people and corporations. We need to send more people like him to Congress. So I have to wonder about we the people as voters. Yes, yes, amen. See, yeah. Darlene says we are sending these opportunistic money grubbers to Congress too. Could they simply be a reflection of us, the electorate? Personal enrichment and wealth are held as a highly desirable item in this country. They are practically considered good values, sacraments even. So, and yeah, there's truth in that. That's why every time I mention, say, a Steve King or a Michelle Bachmann, the first place I go is,
Yeah, they're nuts. But what does that say about the people that put them in office? To the point that you want to look at a Steve King voter like you'd look at an exhibit in a menagerie. And probably with a more jaundiced eye than the exhibit in the menagerie. Yeah, so I'm in agreement with Darlene on that. Let's Irish Dave also noting, by the way, respect for completing high school in the regular manner clearly indicates the capacity to conform to lots of random bullshit. A definite plus in the military mind, and yes, I use the term mind advisably. Irish Dave knows of which he speaks. Thanks to Sal for helping out as well. That makes it 105. So thank you very much, Sal. Your presence is much appreciated, evening by evening. Thank you. Because that adds up to quite a lot over the course of a month. Let's see. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. I think the word that we're all looking for when it comes to people graduating from high school versus the GED, and Jim, again, makes a good observation about his down-to-earth perception of things, is conformity. And with conformity, you can get people to rush up a hill as people with binoculars watch. And, you know, speaking of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, when I was in high school, after having read Animal Farm and 1984 in junior high school, there was something about the kids in my school that were they had more delicate lives than mine, smarter than in some ways, not as smart as far as the streets, and not as smart as the classroom sometimes, but they just kind of had a way of life being easier for them than I noticed for myself. But they seemed to rush towards the Solzhenitsyn thing, and I think it, I don't know if they were predominantly the advanced classes that, and there was something about that didn't spook me, but I thought, you know, it's a lot of big words, and I thought it seems to be part of the Gerald Ford administration. I mean, really did not necessarily put that together, but I kind of did, and we were watching Watergate unfold back then. I thought, you know, I feel sorry for the dude. He's probably got a good heart, but he got himself caught up in North Korea, so to speak, called Russia at the time, so that, you know, henceforth the gulag. But and I don't wish, you know, ill upon him. He seems to be actually the man was a good person, apparently. But so I didn't care to read that. But then I am a socialist from the Midwest, and maybe I stir slower than others. I would just share with Jim or anybody else that's still listening, that I.G. Farben's connection to Allen Dulles, and then, of course, that's Dulles Airport, and that's the new airport in Washington, D.C., obviously, but you know, Dulles worked with Prescott Bush, and then they selected Nixon, and it's funny how John Kennedy ends up getting killed when he resisted the war in Vietnam. So, any case, just some strange connections there. I.G. Farben and then Fritz Thyssen and Thyssen Krupp. And Krupp was the construction company that built the.
Yeah, I still get the creeps when I get in their elevators now.
Well, you know,
you see more Thyssen Krupp than you do Otis anymore.
Well, you know, actually, Bob, Thyssen Krupp has a big operation in Kentucky, but I would say, in defense of the American Thyssen Krupp, they have been predominantly union installed. So even though they spook us emotionally, they should be safe and sound. But anyway, I just wanted to call and share my on WMNF 88.5, Bob, in Tampa. They were talking about exactly what you guys are talking about, the military-industrial prison complex, and the Corrections Corporation of America, the major shareholder at one time, was in fact our vice president, the privatization of jails. And then if you'll jump on there, I think there's a company called Vanguard, which is their parent company. Vanguard is a major power broker with a company called Sturm and Ruger, which is what we Marines carried on embassy duty as
Sturm and Sturm Ruger. Hey, Mark, I got to get out of here. I'm sorry I got to you so quick or so late. Hopefully we'll have a little longer next time.
No problem, Bobby.
All right. See you, man. Bye.
No.
Our buddy Mark. And time to get out of here.
It's real pleasant getting back behind the microphone after 2 days away. Thank you all very much. Rick Smith is up next, only on the Horn.